So I've never been to Woodland Hills.
It's a rare land, the land of wood.
It smells like money.
Does it?
Yeah.
Out here?
Yeah.
Really? It smells like white people, where white people come to breed. Hank Shaw, ladies and gentlemen, we're live. Hank Shaw said Woodland Hills smells like money. You got to go to Beverly Hills. It smells like diamonds.
They don't let people like me in,
they
in
don't?
Beverly Hills, no.
Come on, man. You look respectable.
Barely.
You look fine. You're a chef. How do you go from being a political blogger? You were a political blogger.
Well, then... I was a Capitol Bureau chief in Sacramento and in other places and covered Congress, so I was a bit more than a blogger. But
you were deep in.
Oh, yeah. I was in the room several times.
Watching this thing go down now, this atrocity of justice and voting and chaos and everything that's going around, the Russians are attacking, all this stuff that's going on right now, what does this feel like to you?
It feels so good to not be doing this job anymore. So good.
I feel like anybody that has any sort of intelligence, that is a political blogger, that's involved in it for any length of time, or not necessarily a political blogger, or, you know, a columnist, an author, after a while, you got to realize you're fucking writing about pro wrestling. This is a rig system. You're writing about a rig system, and then occasionally something like this happens.
It used to be, what got me into it, I did it for 18 years.
Wow.
I got into it because when I got into it, the essence of politics was people of different kinds of backgrounds and persuasions, different regions, would all meet in a room, i.e. the Capitol, either it's a state Capitol or Congress, and solve a problem somehow. So it was all about compromise and debate and wheeling and dealing and that kind of stuff, which is inherently fascinating when you're a reporter, like whose ox is going to get gored, who's going to win this, and like, you know, Joe needs this and somebody else needs that. I got to give him this thing, otherwise I'm not going to get his vote. And da da da. And then at the end of the day, you'd have this bill, this transportation. I could go on about some hilarious congressional stories and state government stories.
Please do.
So there was a transportation bill. God, it was a T21 bill in Congress in '98, and one of my guys, a guy named Frank Wolf, he's a lawmaker from Northern Virginia. He's not there anymore. He's kind of a do-gooder, you know, kind of a reformer Republican guy, you know, Dudley Do Right kind of guy. And he hated pork and he wanted to get rid of all the earmarks in the transportation bill. But as you probably know, the transportation bill is what they call a Christmas tree. So everybody gets a little bit of an ornament on top of the tree so that they can go home to their district and say, look what I got. So Bud Schuster of Pennsylvania was the head of the Transportation Committee back then. So Bud would shut the door, and anybody in the Transportation Committee was one of Bud's boys. You weren't a Republican, you weren't a Democrat, you were one of Bud's boys. And so they all play a game like this. And so except for my guy would come out and hold press releases saying, oh, you know, this is terrible, you know, this is corruption, blah, blah, blah. Nah, that's how the game is played. You know, everybody gets a little piece. So it comes out and the bill passes over Frank's dead body, basically. And he holds a press release or a press conference talking about how terrible it all was. And I'm coming out of this press conference and one of Bud Schuster's aides comes and says, hey, check out page 123 of the bill. So I did. And in there was a line item that gave the residents of Bud Schuster's congressional district a free pass to drive the Pennsylvania Turnpike for X number of years. So basically anybody who lived in Bud's district didn't have to pay tolls for, I think it was 2 years. Awesome.
That's ridiculous.
Well, there was a reason, because the road that most of those people took to work there was going to be construction on it for like the next 2 years.
Oh, well, that's fairly reasonable then.
Yeah, you could justify it in front of a court of law. It's not being completely. But, you know, I mean, cases were like, yeah, check out page 123. We stuck something in there.
It's still going on, too. I mean, that's what's so bizarre, that even in this age of transparency, they're still like stacking stuff in, sliding things into bills.
And there's very few people to watch them now.
Yes. And there's too many things to look at anyway. Even if there is something.
Squirrel.
Yeah. Even if something does get in, there's going to be some new scandal tomorrow. Kanye West going to be visiting Trump at the Trump Tower. And they're like, you're not going to think about the bill anymore.
Exactly.
There's too much to pay attention to, Hank Shaw. Which is why I find it fascinating that you went from that world to much more of an artistic pursuit of being a chef. And that's something that I've like really come to appreciate over the last, say, 10 years or so. And I credit the initial push to watching No Reservations.
Oh, yeah.
When Anthony Bourdain's show was on the Travel Channel. Because I always loved food. You know, I like eating. Everybody does, you know. But I never really thought of food.
Dietitians don't like eating.
Which ones?
Registered dietitians.
They don't?
They don't like eating.
Well, they don't like the pleasure aspect of it. They want everybody to just say, like, there's a fucking guy that I know. He's like, I don't eat for taste. I eat for performance. He eats, like, oatmeal with water, and he doesn't heat it up. I'm like, get the fuck out of here, you asshole. This episode is brought to you by Manscaped. Guys, you're responsible for taking care of you, and that means spending some time cleaning yourself up. But I know that can be a challenge, especially when you're not sure what products or razors to use. So to help you get started, I want to recommend Manscaped. They can help you take care of all your grooming needs, even when it comes to your more sensitive areas, or as our friends at Manscaped like to call them, the boys. Their trimmers, the Lawnmower 3.0 Plus, 4.0 Pro, and 5.0 Ultra are all equipped with skin-safe technology to help reduce the risk of grooming accidents. They're also waterproof and come with an LED spotlight so you can actually see what you're shaving. And I know that summer's coming, which means vacations and traveling for a lot of you. Well, Manscaped has you covered. Their trimmers come with a convenient travel case that you can easily pack and bring along. For the best you and your boys have ever looked, trust Manscaped. Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code Rogan at manscaped.com. That's 20% off plus free shipping with the code Rogan at manscaped.com. Tap the banner to learn more. Skin-safe technology does not guarantee cut protection. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for something to do this summer, you might want to check out some of the upcoming fights. Even better, if you can catch them up close in person. It's quite an experience. But if you want to get the best seats, you have to act fast. And that's true for a lot of things in life, especially when it comes to hiring for your business. You need to hire the most talented people you can before the competition scoops them up. And to do that, you need ZipRecruiter. And luckily, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. Got your eye on a rock star candidate? ZipRecruiter's invite to apply feature lets you cut the line. Once you review ZipRecruiter's list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply to encourage them to apply sooner. So, amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan to try it for free right now. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. It's people that just, you're missing the point. You could do both, stupid. But the point being that I thought of food as being like great, like, oh, this tastes good, I like this. I didn't think of it as an art. And then when I watched Anthony Bourdain's show, when he would have this like great reverence for these people that he would visit, who were these real artists, and they would put together these amazing dishes, and the enthusiasm and the passion that he had for describing it made me like super excited about it. And then I started realizing, oh wow, I never thought about it like this. This is an art form. This is just an art form, like, you know, in the way that you would like make a sandcastle. You know, it's not going to last forever. You're making a meal. You can take a photo of it.
It is not unlike stand-up comedy.
In a lot of ways.
It's performance art. It lasts for as long as you're in the restaurant or as long as you're in that comedy hall.
Yeah, if like you couldn't record comedy where, like, you could record a meal and film it, like on Anthony Bourdain's show, and
sure,
I can't appreciate
it
at home. But I could watch you if you did stand up and I laughed at home. I don't have to be there.
That's true. So
it serves more people, but in the sense, the same way. Like if there was no recordings, it would be kind of very similar in a lot of ways, but shared with larger groups of people.
Right. I mean, and in cooking, when you bring it up to that kind of a level, and I hesitate to use the word artist with cooks and chefs.
It sounds pretentious, right?
We're artisans. Mm. We're craftsmen.
But that's an artist too. Like, what's the difference?
Well, okay. So, there are some people who will say that my cooking leaves you with a deep feeling of whatever, you know, ennui or happiness or joy or farts or whatever. And we're cooking good food. We are buying product. We are making product in a way that will make you interested in it, and will delight you in some way, shape, or form. And you know, there's a very famous old Spanish chef whose name escapes me. It's at the end of every Michelin-starred meal ends with a good shit.
So I don't, that's a great way of looking at it.
I just don't want to take myself that seriously.
Well, good for you. But that's the same thing as comedians. Like, my comedy changes worlds, changes minds. It influences. I'm an influencer. I think it's important to get my message out there and use my platform. No, dude, you're joking. You're telling. You're making people laugh, ultimately. Well, what comics are freed from that today in this very unique form because of the internet and because of podcasts. So because of podcasts, comics, if you have actually something that you want to say that is not necessarily funny, you can do that now. Because podcasts are so open-ended, there's no real structure to it. Whereas, like, if you go on stage, and people did for the longest time, they would go on stage and rant about the government or about abortion or about crime or whatever, and it would be not funny. And they would feel like it was something that was important. So it had to be discussed, even though it was discussed in this weird forum where people go to pay to see comedy, and you're not giving them comedy, you're ranting. And it was almost like respected under like some snobbish sort of sect of stand-up comedy fans and practitioners. It was a real weird time. I blame Bill Hicks. Do you know who Bill Hicks is? Yeah. Bill Hicks did it perfectly, but the way he did it, a lot of people imitated it to the point where there's a famous comedy club in Georgia called The Punchline that went under, and it had a back room, the green room where the comics would hang out, and everybody wrote on the walls. And one section of this wood-paneled wall said, "Quit trying to be Hicks." And Jamie, the owner, says he's going to get me that because they tore it down. They saved those pieces.
Yeah, I mean,
put it up in here somewhere.
You can, by all means, make a statement, but make it funny.
Yeah, man, that's where it's hard. It's hard to do that. But so some people like took the shortcut and they just wanted to be self-righteous.
It's hard to do molecular gastronomy and make it actually soulful.
Ooh, molecular gastronomy is what he's calling cooking, ladies and gentlemen.
Not my cooking, but that's tweezers, foams, spherification, calcium lactate, all that kind
of stuff. Yeah, what is that all about? Like, some people go too deep, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're kind of the opposite. You're like, one of the things that I've really enjoyed about seeing some of your dishes, that you like to cook things, like, say, if you're cooking, like, a wild pork loin, you want to use a lot of the ingredients that are in the area where that animal lives.
Yeah, I'm not the first person to do that, but it's one of the things that I do a lot. What goes together in the field or in the water or in the seashore or whatever almost always will go together on the plate. So, I mean, I've done such weird stuff as, you know, when I go grouse hunting, well, what were the grouse eating? You can tell what was in the crop.
Wow.
And like that, I'll never forget, there was this moment in, we were in North Dakota hunting sharptail grouse, and the grouse had all been eating rose hips. So I'm like, yep, got to make a rose hip glaze on these Sharpies.
A rose hip glaze. What does rose hips taste like?
They're a little bit like, they're loaded with vitamin C, so they have that kind of acidy twang to them. But they're, like, imagine a cross between a watermelon and an orange. Ooh, it's something like that.
That's what rose hips taste like?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just buy rose hips at the store and eat them?
Because the center of a rose hip, is what they used to make itching powder out of.
That's what it looks like, Jamie?
Oh, look at that.
That's a rose hip?
Mm-hmm.
It's a fruit.
It is. It's the end of the rose. And, I mean, that's what a rose becomes.
Really?
And there's a variety called,
How the fuck do I not know this? I have roses.
Well, they don't always get pollinated.
Oh.
So when they get pollinated, the best one is called a rugosa rose. And it is it's a coastal rose. It lives in beaches and dunes. And the rose hip there is like the size of a cherry pepper. It's like that.
Wow.
Yeah, that's something, a solid, you know, half dollar size. If people remember what a half dollar looks like, it's that big, and it's juicy like a sweet pepper. But you don't eat the center because the center is what they used to make itching powder out of.
Itching powder.
Uh-huh.
Oh, Jesus Christ! So it's like one of those.
So you kind of eat around the edges.
Blowfish that can kill you, like,
well,
that kind of a deal.
But it just, it
not
sucks.
That bad.
It's
but
just
it's
like.
Oh no! But the outside's yummy.
Yeah.
Wow, how bizarre. Put that photo up again. I literally had no idea that they looked like that.
Yeah, see,
so
those,
that center part is nasty.
Right, so you eat
it
around
nasty.
It. Now, if it dries and you, I make a rose hip puree. So I'll get that kind of rose hip and dry it. And and then you rehydrate it, and then you boil it just so it gets soft, and then you run it through a food mill. So only the red flesh comes through, and all those seeds stay in the food mill. And you get this incredibly amazing-looking paste that looks exactly like tomato paste, but it's like concentrated rosehip flavor.
Oh.
And it's ridiculously good.
Wow. And that's – what is that back there? Back that up one, Jamie. That's like a puree or something. Is that like how they would make that? You would grind that up in some sort of a way?
It's probably the extract. I mean, they make jellies out of it a lot. And the Swedes and Norwegians make fruit soups out of it.
How do I not know this? This is so. I really thought rose hips were somehow or another like a rose leaf.
Mm-mm.
I thought you took like the – because I know those things must taste good because deer eat them like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
They like my friend's wife was like, oh, I love animals. It's so cute. We have deers in the yard. Then she started planting.
I know where this is going.
They all go the same way. They started planting the roses. The deer can't beat the roses. She's like, these fucking cunts need to die.
Kill them.
She's out there with a crossbow.
All. Kill them all.
Yeah. So his wife like literally wants to murder these deer because they're killing her flowers. It's funny.
It's like, honey, we need a tag.
Yeah. She's going to try to get a tag from Malibu.
Ooh, Malibu. Lots of luck.
I know. Malibu just granted a stay, a pardon on that mountain lion who's been killing all the alpacas up there. I don't know if you heard that story.
No, but it's awesome.
It's a fascinating story because there's a mountain lion. His name is P45. He's actually been collared, and they know who he is. They know he has an active radio collar on him, so they know it's him. And he's just murking these alpacas. He killed, 11 alpacas and one goat.
That's the stupidest, slowest deer I've ever chased.
They're in a cage. He just hops the fence and has a slaughter fest. I mean, he's not even eating them. He's just fucking them up, you know. I think he's plenty of food up there. He just decided to eat them because they were, or kill them because they were there. And so they decided that they could pass a depredation permit on him. So they're going to kill him. And so then there's this outrage. And the woman who owns the alpaca farm apparently was, like, really scared because she was like, I just wasn't prepared for the vitriol.
Mm-hmm.
And so now she doesn't want it killed. She's not going to use the depredation order. She's instead wants someone to somehow or another take it away and put it somewhere else.
Probably up in NorCal where I live. I've seen 5 mountain lions wandering around in the wild. I mean, they're around.
Oh, there's a lot. There's one today.
Big kitties.
There's one today, a video they put up of this guy in his home, looks out on his front porch, and there's a fucking mountain lion killing a deer on his front porch. It was just put out today. Did you see it, Jamie? Did you see that one? It's crazy. I mean, it's in a suburban neighborhood. It's a big cat, too, and it's just dragging this deer on his front porch. Like, whoa, Jesus Christ. Here it is. Like, this is this guy's security. The mountain lion was caught on camera Thursday attacking a deer in a resident's front porch in San Francisco.
San Francisco?
Yes. Watch. Look at this. I mean, this is fucking San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Yeah. And it's dragging the deer away. This is crazy.
Okay. That's amazing because, I mean, both of us have been to San Francisco. That thing must be living in Golden Gate Park.
Well, the crazy thing
is, it came up from the peninsula where there's a fair bit of habitat for it.
It's very strange what they're able to do and how they're able to move around. They're just so smart. Oh, the deer had been eating roses.
See?
Well, fuck them.
Sometimes you got to pay rent.
That's the mountain lions hired by the fucking rose owners to jack the deer. Yeah, it's amazing how they can get around. They killed a giant one in Santa Monica in someone's backyard. Santa Monica, which is like deeply populated. And this guy called up, I don't know, the police, I guess, and said, hey, there's a fucking giant mountain lion in my yard. And they couldn't figure out how to get it out of there. So they killed it.
Hmm.
It was, you know, 150-pound cat in Santa Monica just wandering around.
That's pretty big. They get bigger.
Do they be really?
200.
Do they get two?
God, oh, yeah.
That's a giant one, huh?
Big kitty. You see them in, like, Utah.
Well, I was listening to this podcast yesterday where they were talking about spotting jaguars in Arizona. They're
mm-hmm.
spotting them more and more lately.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, they've spotted a couple of them now.
And in in Texas, too. In
really?
The very southern part of Texas.
It's so interesting. It's like part of you is like, yeah, that's cool. They're coming back here. Part of them is like, wait, it's cool as long as there's only a couple of them.
Right.
Like, you don't want too many jaguars running around where the kids are playing, folks.
Well, it's like sea lions. I have nothing against sea lions, but there aren't enough great white sharks to make the sea lion population kind of normal. So we're just blitzed with sea lions up in Northern California.
Have you ever seen the video that they took of people right on Fisherman's Wharf?
They took his mahi-mahi?
It's No. They're killing seals or sea lions. What, like,
they're killing seals on Fisherman's Wharf?
Giant, huge sharks.
Oh, sharks.
Murking these sea lions right next to the Fisherman's Wharf. So these people were there filming. And
I did see that.
While they're hanging out, here it is. Right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is New York.
These people are hanging out. And they're like, we're just going to, oh, shit, boom. And look at all the blood in the water. I mean, and they all come to the side of the edge to look over the edge of the dock. And I guess this is a security camera that's on this boat that's filming this. But I mean, look at all the fucking blood. That is crazy.
They're warm-blooded mammals.
Yeah.
This one's rapidly cooling.
So
I've caught all kinds of sharks. You see where that powerboat is in the background? Go about 150 yards towards Alcatraz, or actually that's towards Angel Island. And there are seven gill sharks, big, big, big seven gill sharks that live in that channel.
What's
right
a
there.
Seven gill sharks? A different type of shark?
It is. It's a really, really primitive kind of shark. They're actually quite tasty. And you're allowed one a day. And they cruise the bottom in the deep channels in San Francisco Bay. It's actually one of the best places to catch them outside of New Zealand.
How deep is that?
It can be over 100.
So you just troll at the bottom, or you just drop a line down?
You either anchor up or you bounce bottom off.
Oh, wow. What a cool-looking shark.
Yeah, they're crazy-looking.
Wow, they do look really primitive. You know, it's interesting. Sharks, because of the whole shark fin soup controversy, this...
Which is not good, by the way, if you've ever had it.
I have had it.
I have had it once, and I'm like, no thank you.
It was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't anything that I think you should slaughter sharks for.
Precisely.
Especially not just the fin. Like, it's so bizarre.
It's the worst.
There's so much meat on a shark that...
It's the worst, you know.
But what I was going to say is that there's this new... sort of a liberal knee-jerk reaction to sharks, that now you're not supposed to kill sharks. So there was I think it was the mayor of New York City, or was it the governor, that caught a thresher shark. And it's not an endangered species. Mm-hmm. It's a totally legal fish to catch.
And you'll see him at fish markets.
And he caught it and cooked it, and people just jumped on the outrage train and started getting angry that he was killing endangered sharks. And everybody was like, whoa. This is not – we're not making shark fin soup. We're not some gigantic Chinese commercial fishing vehicle.
Right.
Here it is. New York governor in hot water over shark photo.
And that's a little fresher too.
It's total legal.
Yeah.
It's a fish. I mean, it's not a fish. It's a shark, but it's no different. I mean, it's what it is.
I get that a lot because I fish for leopard sharks in San Francisco Bay and Tamales Bay every year. They're delicious. They're fantastic. And everyone gets – I get the same reaction, but I'm like, wait. First of all, they're a species of least concern if you look at all the fish monitoring things and whatever. And we're keeping like four for the whole season. And because they can get reasonably big, and it's the common shark that lives up there, and everybody, I think that when you get down to it, is Americans are not really good at nuance,
right?
And you know, it's like, oh well, one shark's endangered, so they all must be endangered. I'm just like, no.
Well, there's a very cursory glimpse at the facts and what they're going to get outraged at before they decide to pull the outrage chute. They're just like, pull it. He's got a shark. Pull it.
Yep.
Outrage. There's not enough time in the day to really pay attention to all the different animals that are being consumed and what you should be concerned with and whatnot. So you think, I think I read somewhere that sharks are endangered and he's got a shark. Hey man, fuck you. And they
Precisely.
They have a fillet of fish in their stomach. You know, they were eating fries cooked in beef fat as they were on the way over there.
Which are good, by the way.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. But these leopard sharks, now what is the difference in, like, I've had mako, it's the only shark I've ever eaten. Mm-hmm. What would you say a leopard would
it's
be?
It's pretty dramatically different because makos and threshers are much more like swordfish. So swordfish, sturgeon, makos, and threshers all kind of are in the same culinary bucket. They're like a steak.
Like a thick, meaty.
Yeah.
I like that. A lot of people don't, though, right?
Some people don't, but
it's,
you know, no accounting for taste. But a leopard sharks, which you have down here in SoCal. Leopard shark is super, super white. It's very dense. It's a little bit more like grouper is how I would describe it.
Interesting.
It's an amazing – now, I mean, there's a trick to it. So if you're going to fish for these fish, you need to have ice on board. and you need to basically catch the fish, you kill the fish, and then you gut the fish right there, and then you get them on ice because sharks, skates, and rays effectively pee through their skin. So if you don't gut the fish right after you kill it, you get this buildup of uric acid in the meat, and it's basically your fish fillet is going to smell like ammonia, which nobody likes.
So that's interesting. Skates and rays are the same as well, huh?
Mm-hmm. So all three, I think if I have to remember, they're I'm going to forget it. It's elasmomorphs or something. I forget what the scientific name is, but it's a cartilaginous fish.
Now, the variations in sharks, that's a very extreme variation, the difference between like a grouper and a swordfish, mm-hmm. which is like a real thick, meaty. What accounts for that?
Diet. Yeah. Leopard sharks like crabs, crustaceans, shellfish, that sort of thing. Although they actually really, really dig this nasty little fish called a midshipman, which is this, it looks like the ugliest catfish you've ever seen. And here's a pro tip for you. The best bait to catch a leopard shark is what was ever in the previous leopard shark's stomach. Just bait your hook up with whatever was in its stomach, and then you will absolutely catch another leopard shark.
Huh. And this is the...
the midshipman, yeah.
Midshipman. Yeah. What a strange-looking fish.
And well, the other good thing about them is not only do the sharks love them, but they stay in the hook forever.
Do they, like, have a thick outer shell or something?
Yeah, there's...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's... And see the luminescent dots on the bottom? That's pretty cool.
Wow. What a cool-looking thing. How big do those things get?
Well, about like that.
But that's it? That's about as big? So they're essentially just little tiny bait fish.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, wow, they can get maybe 10 inches long, maybe?
What a cool-looking fish, though. That's so prehistoric looking.
There's a little ray. Actually, it's a skate.
Yeah, go back to that other thing again. This episode is brought to you by Simply Safe. With summer coming up, I bet a lot of you have plans to travel, which is great. You should get out and experience the world. But I also know how stressful traveling can be. That's why I want to recommend Simply Safe. It provides award-winning security and peace of mind so you can have one less thing to worry about when you're away from your home this summer. I think Simply Safe is a great option for home security because it protects your whole home, inside and out. It has a variety of cameras and sensors to detect the worst of the worst, including fires, floods, break-ins, and more. Simply Safe has your back, and I especially like how there's no contracts and a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it out confidently and really see if Simply Safe is a good fit for you and your place. Everyone deserves to have peace of mind when they're away from home, and Simply Safe can help give you that. So try it out today. Right now, get 20% off any new Simply Safe system with Fast Protect monitoring at simplysafe.com/Rogan. That's simplysafe.com/Rogan. There's no safe like Simply Safe. This episode is brought to you by Mizzen and Main. No matter where you're listening, no matter what job you have, the clothes you wear to work say a lot about you. And if you're wearing boring, stiff, uncomfortable dress shirts, well, now might be the time to ditch some of the dated, boring styles in your workplace wardrobes. And that's exactly what Mizzen and Main is for. When I wear my shirt, I feel like I'm not sacrificing comfort for style. Their performance fabric dress shirts feel just as good as they look, and you could put on a Mizzen and Main and dress for the job you have. You will see it hanging in your closet and genuinely get excited to put it on. And if you're still dry cleaning your dress shirts, you're living in the past. Welcome to 2024, where Mizzen and Main has the world's most comfortable machine washable dress shirts. Mizzen and Main invented the performance fabric dress shirt 10 years ago, and they've practically perfected the thing. It's lightweight, breathable, moisture wicking, wrinkle resistant, and the most comfortable shirt on the market. Whatever you do, and wherever you wear it, know that you'll look and feel amazing. Shop now at MizzenandMain.com and save 20% when you spend $130 or more using the promo code Joe Rogan. Yeah. Look at that thing. That's
so bizarre. Little bioluminescent dots underneath it.
So in deep, deep water, that thing, that's all visible?
Yep. It's like racing stripes on one of those tricked out sports cars, you know, Nissan Maxima.
Like my sneakers. Like if you rent, these are, these things, like you see them at night.
Oh, they glow?
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah.
Oh, like perfect.
They reflect.
Yeah.
So that's, that actually is like luminescent though. It's not that it reflects light.
Yeah.
It actually exudes light.
Right.
Wow. That's a trip. See, that's I am as fascinated by the ocean as any other part of the world. And I just think it's so incredible that we've only explored like 90, I think.
2% or something ridiculous like that?
Yeah, I think 90-something percent is unknown. Unexplored. That's so strange.
Yeah, there you go.
Look at that thing.
But it's funny. I mean, wow. I'm known as the game guy, right? But I've spent most of my life dealing with fish and shellfish and seafood. And I only started hunting when I was 30.
That's interesting. Yeah, adult onset hunting is many people call it, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you cook something like a shark or anything that's controversial, anything along those lines, do you feel like you have to preface it with some sort of an explanation that this is not an endangered species and that it is a giant misconception and this is no different than eating a tuna? Or
I usually put a paragraph or something in there to say
when you're writing something.
Yeah,
about
yeah,
it, right?
You'd be like, you know, hold on, people, this is not, you know. Yeah, it's not a white shark. It's not, you know, it's not an endangered species at all. I mean, it's just, you know, and I'll usually put a link to the where it says it's IUCN, is the International Union of Concern, whatever's, and it's basically it's the marker that shows what's endangered, what's threatened, what's the species of least concern, and you know, even then, if you think about it, our bag limit for leopard sharks in the San Francisco Bay is 3 a day, and we typically do a self-imposed limit of only 2 a day, and we almost never keep females.
When you say we, meaning you and your friends, the
no,
people
meaning
you fish
most
with?
Most of the commercial fishing fleet, and like so, if you could take a charter in the
you,
bay,
you mean commercial, like recreational?
Yeah, like charter,
okay.
Charter boats.
Right, okay.
They'll typically like, do you need 3 fish? Like you can have for 3 fish, but it's sort of strongly encouraged. Just you know,
oh, that's
just,
cool.
Just take the 2. We're going to throw these big giant females back because a lot of times, especially this time of year, they can have pups because they give birth to live young.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to, you know, open up a shark that's got little pups inside. That's just wrong.
Have you ever seen that? Is it an X-ray or a sonogram of sharks with the baby sharks in their stomach?
No, I've never seen it.
Well, most people don't know probably that sharks do what you say, have live young inside of them.
Yep.
But they're like these I put it up on my Instagram because it's so crazy looking that it looks fake. It's like they're little monsters living inside this other shark's body. See if you can find it.
Well, if you look at a human fetus,
look at this.
Like 4 days.
Look at that. Look at his mouth going open.
Oh, yeah.
But there's images of it that's better, Jamie. There's some that's you can get a look at what it looks like. I mean, that's fucking crazy. I mean, that's what and some of them eat their fellow brothers and sisters inside the womb. Like they'll eat the weaker ones.
That's why you shouldn't have more than 5 kids.
But what the fuck? How do they eat? And they're eating inside a womb. Like what kind of a monster is a shark that they can eat while they're in the womb and they have teeth already? They have fangs.
Well, you know, human babies have teeth when they're born, don't they?
No.
No, that's right. They don't.
No.
Yeah,
you don't have kids, right. Do you?
Nah.
Yeah.
None that I know of.
You skated through. You passed the breeding point.
I'm pretty sure
you
I
got
have.
Through. How old are you now?
45 or 46.
Did you come close at any time?
Not that I know of.
No?
No.
Good for you. There's plenty of fucking people. That's one thing people with kids will try to tell you, like that everybody needs kids. Like, I have kids. Let me tell you something. Everybody doesn't need kids. There's plenty of people. You could be a wonderful contributing member to our culture and society without reproducing.
Yep.
It's nonsense.
It's not everybody's path.
But one thing about babies is they don't eat other babies while they're in the womb.
That you know of.
They do absorb them, though, don't they? Like some weird twins.
Oh,
like
weird.
There's weird Siamese twins where one twin will absorb the other one, and then they'll find like a tooth in the baby's head.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah,
I think it's called
a
dermoid.
Ooh, that's a good name for it.
It'd be a good name for a kid. What's your name? Dermoid.
But there are a lot of meals now that people look down upon, and that's becoming one of them, right? Sharks. Sharks
Squirrel.
Is becoming one of them. Squirrel's another one.
Squirrel's mostly, that's a mostly urban people like to make fun of rural people for eating squirrels. It's a sign of like, oh, you must be a hick.
Well, if you go to certain, there's a park in North Hollywood that near where I used to live, and you can go there and feed them peanuts. It's kind of cool. They come right up to you. You just lay down. As long as you're laying down, the squirrels will literally, you lay down and hold up a peanut, and the squirrels will literally come up to you and take your peanut. And people feel bad about that. Like, we have weird rules about what animals we like, what animals we don't. Because if it was a rat that came over and took your peanut, you'd be freaking out. And there's not a whole lot of difference between a squirrel and a rat.
It's the tail, dude.
Yeah, that tail's so fluffy and adorable, and it sticks up. And it looks like it's talking to you.
Tree rat with good PR.
Tree rat with good PR, and something about fuzziness will let them in. Come on in. As long as you eat just plants, you know, which is not true. Apparently, there's a video of a squirrel they caught eating some sort of a mammal, like a mouse or something like that.
They eat eggs all the time too.
Do they?
Mm-hmm.
Like ground nesting birds' eggs?
No, or well,
they go in a tree.
Tree, yeah.
Oh wow! There it is. Look at this. Look at this fucking squirrel eating this mouse like it's a sandwich.
That reminds me of that Monty Python rabbit.
This is so crazy. Like, how often does this happen?
You know, ground squirrels in California. There are guys. I haven't done it, but there are guys who will go out and shoot ground squirrels.
Keep that up there.
Like when you shoot Louie, Joe comes out of his hole and grabs Louie and eats him.
Oh, Jesus.
It's a little horrible. I mean, it's like
instantaneously they just started eating.
I never liked you anyway. You know, I mean, it's just horrible.
There's a ranch that I go to, Tejon Ranch.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Tejon Ranch, one of the guys who's a guide there told me that the biomass, this is a morbid scene.
It is.
The squirrel, we're sitting here talking while this squirrel is eating intestines.
It's just pretty much
from this
eating
mouse.
The entire mouse.
Oh, my God. And he's going off, too. The biomass of ground squirrels. Is he a ground squirrel? He must be, right? He looks like it with his little squirrely tail.
He does look like a ground squirrel.
Yeah. Squirrely little bastard. The biomass of ground squirrels is more than any other animal on the ranch. It's 270,000 acres with mountain lions, deer,
elk,
pigs, yeah. And there's more weight of ground squirrels than anything else.
I would love to be able to tell you that, yeah, they're delicious, but they tend to carry bubonic plague.
Oh.
Which does not make them good eats.
Yeah. You can eat regular squirrels, but you can't eat ground squirrels?
Tree squirrels, yes. Ground squirrels, no.
What is the difference in the species? Are they interchangeable? Are they hybrids ever?
No, they're totally different species. And the western gray tree squirrel is really, really big. He's over 2 pounds, and he's kind of a very cold slate gray. And it's quite good eating squirrel. There used to be a very high limit on them here in California, but when Southeast Asian immigrants, the Hmong came, so the Hmong are very fond of squirrel hunting. And so it was a big thing what they did back in Southeast Asia. And so when they caught here, they're like, sweet, there are all these squirrels. And I guess they shot them out because the limits were 10 in the 70s and early 80s, and now they're just 4. Which is fairly low. You know, for example, in some of the Appalachian states, it's 10.
So that's interesting. The Hmongs, I've heard that before. They're a big hunting community.
Yeah. Of the recent immigrants to this country, the two most huntingest groups are the Hmong and the Russians.
Interesting.
And when I say Russians, I mean sort of very, you know, Russians, Ukrainians, Moldovans.
Right.
You know.
Do they have a preference for, like, what they go after?
Well,
like,
I know the Russians been putting a herd on our sturgeon up north.
Sturgeon?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it's mostly poaching. Fish and Game is having a hard time getting a handle on it.
Now, do they like sturgeon for the caviar or for the meat?
Yeah, for the caviar.
Oh, wow.
So
But that would have to be a female. So how do you differentiate when you're catching them?
Well, you can. They're pretty slow. They're pretty calm, slow fish. So it's pretty easy to determine if it's a male or a female. And if it's, I mean, it'll look sort of, they call it gravid, but it looks pregnant if it's a big female.
Okay.
And the other thing is they're almost always oversized fish. So we're allowed 3 a year in California legally, and they have to be, I'm going to forget this. I think it's 40 to 60 inches from the fork of the tail. That might be a slight layoff, but that's basically the legal size.
Legal size is 40 inches.
Oh, yeah.
You have to catch something 40 inches. That's a big-ass fish.
State record's, I think, 8.5 feet long.
Wow, in California?
Yeah, it's either 8 or 10. It's huge. The state record was caught by a dude in Vallejo. He caught it in the Carquinez Straits in, like, I want to say the 80s, judging by the haircut.
Now, where are they? Are you catching them in deep water? Like, how do you catch a sturgeon?
You can catch them in Sacramento. You can catch them in Colusa. You can catch them in the Delta.
Are they in rivers? Are they in?
Yeah, they're in rivers. And then they go out into the bay.
Wow.
But the general place you're going to fish for them is going to be the Delta, out of Antioch, out of San Pablo Bay, that kind of area.
Now, these sturgeon, are they biting hooks or are you snagging them?
No, they're biting hooks.
What do they get? What do they feed?
So depending on who you talk to, there's a friend of mine named Jay Lopes who runs a guide service there. He's a specialist in sturgeon. He really loves cured salmon roe.
Oh.
So, and he's got some special thing that he does with the salmon roe. But some people use ghost shrimp. Some people use cut herring. They'll eat all kinds of stuff.
The largest freshwater fish on record for California is a white sturgeon caught by Joey Pallotta.
Yep,
1983.
Joey Pallotta. I knew it was the 80s.
You knew it. The huge fish weighed an amazing 468 pounds. Whoa, that's a big fucking fish, man. That's amazing.
The story of that fish is pretty hilarious too, because he was working. And he cut off work at, you know, so I think it was in June or oh no, July. Yeah, so it was still light out late. So he caught this fish after work and he couldn't get the damn thing in. So he's like, it's dragging him all around the Carquinez Straits, and I guess he gets on another boat like mid catch. And it was a bigger boat that could actually control it because the sturgeon was just dragging him up and down. And it's just the story, if you can find the story of it, it's just hilarious.
Is that it? Wow, look at the size of it.
And it is a story that will, and that fish will never be broken because that would be an illegal fish right now.
Why is it illegal?
Because you're not allowed to land anything bigger than 60 inches from the fork of the tail.
Oh, well, how the fuck are you going to measure that? Like, what if it's like, you're like, hold on, get the fish close. I'm going to get out the ruler.
Like, well, if it's close,
you just cut the line.
Well, now if it's close, you can. They're really survivable fish. They don't die easy, so you can. I think you bring them on board. You bring them on board, measure them, and then throw them back.
Huh. Now, is that a good fish to eat outside of the roe?
I love sturgeon.
How do you eat it?
Sturgeon again. I would say if you've never eaten sturgeon, imagine swordfish.
Oh,
it's a lot like that.
No kidding.
It's a signature dish of Sacramento cuisine, actually. So if you go to restaurants in Sacramento, you will see sturgeon all over our menus.
People don't know about Sacramento. Sacramento is so different than California in terms of like how LA people think, or you know, San Diego people think.
Yep.
Sacramento might as well be like Iowa.
Mm,
I don't mean in a bad way. I love Iowa. I mean in terms of like the hunting and fishing and the outdoors people and the.
It's more like the Twin Cities.
Oh, okay, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, like Minnesota. Yeah, that makes sense.
So here's a stat for you that I just my girlfriend Holly just told me. She was doing some research for a piece that she was working on. 95% of Californians are urban. 95% of California is rural.
Ooh.
Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. Wow.
And over a third of this state is public land.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It's remarkable. And it's, you know, it's why I stay here.
That whole public land, private land thing is something that I had literally no knowledge of, no interest in, never discussed until I met Ranella. And when Steve Ranella started explaining to me the difference between public land and private land and how it was all put in place by Teddy Roosevelt and all the conservation that was done in the 1800s and how much resistance was behind it. And he actually talked about it pretty in depth in a podcast we did here a couple of weeks ago. And I can't believe it took me until I was like 45 until I heard about that.
It's, you know, actually, Steve's got a really good example of why you might not necessarily have to. It's because he was talking at the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and he used to live in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
weirdly.
Yeah. Well, his wife was working there.
Right, I know.
Yeah. It's when I met him, he was there.
It's still kind of odd. But
it is.
Because he's about as Michigan as you get.
Yeah.
And so he's like, yeah, well, everybody in New York City knows, can you know, cite you chapter and verse, the subway lines.
Mm-hmm.
No one who doesn't have reason to has any reason to know about the subway lines. So when somebody who lives in rural Montana or whatever says, why haven't you ever, you know, this issue with public land, blah, blah, blah. Well, if I live in New York City, I don't have to know. It's just like we were saying at the beginning of this, it's like there's too many things to look at. There's too many distractions in our world right now. And it's just it makes it hard to do anything anymore. There's no quiet at all in our lives anymore.
Mm. Most people's lives, yeah. Yeah, that's Steve's got a real good way of breaking things down like that. He's got a good way of providing you with examples that you go, oh, yeah, That's a good one, you know, because, yeah, if you lived in Montana, you wouldn't give a shit about the subway lines right? of Brooklyn. And if you lived in Brooklyn, the infringing on public lands or Paul Ryan's plans to sell them mm-hmm. off to corporations so that they could pay off the debt, it just doesn't even register.
Well, here's a good one for you. So depending on where you live, like most of us call it public land.
Mm-hmm.
Other people call it government land.
Mm.
With a very different connotation.
Yeah, because the government land means it's not ours, mm-hmm. but it's really ours.
Right.
So if you call it government land, it seems like, well, if they sell it, it's not yours anyway.
Right.
But it actually is yours, mm-hmm. which is that is a weird one that takes a while to absorb. Like the land is actually the people of the United States are the owners of the land.
Right.
So if you go hunting on public land, you're like, you know, the backcountry hunters and angler shirts they have. It says public yeah. landowner. Yeah. I love that shirt because we're all public landowners. You pay taxes. You live in America. You own public land.
Similarly, all the game on everybody's mm-hmm. land, public or private, yeah. belongs to either the people of the United States or, if it's migratory, the people of Canada, the United States, and Mexico.
Or if you're in Texas and it's a high fence.
Well, yeah, that's legally livestock.
Yeah, that's real weird, right? That's a strange distinction, the difference between public land and private land and the animals being on it. Even if it's private land, those animals are owned by people.
Right.
By the people.
Right.
Meaning public.
Which is why we actually have deer.
Yeah, that's the only reason why. Well, that and large-scale agriculture, the populations are higher than ever before and all that good stuff.
Actually, there's a great book called Deerland that talks about why, if you go to the Northeast, they're overrun with whitetails.
Mm.
Because whitetails like the edges between field and forest. And suburbia is their perfect habitat for it.
Yeah. Well, the problem that goes with that is, of course, deer ticks
yeah.
and Lyme disease, which yeah. is run rampant through the Northeast. It's just
Steve has it.
Yeah. Steve has it. His son has it. Yeah. And they are amongst two people out of, I don't know, maybe 10 that I've ever met that have been misdiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
I had this guy, Stephen Kotler, on here the other day who was misdiagnosed for a year, for one fucking year. And because of that, it got so deep into his system that he was in bed for 3 years in the hospital.
Oh, man.
He was hospitalized for 3 fucking years from Lyme disease.
Unreal.
It's a horror story. It's so scary. You know, and you talk to people that have had it, and one of the really fascinating things about Steve, he's really smart, Stephen Kotler.
Right.
And when he was discussing it, he was talking about the neurological aspects of Lyme disease, that it really wreaks havoc on your cognitive function to the point where one time when he had it before he was diagnosed, he didn't know what was wrong with him. He was at a green light, and he couldn't figure out what green meant.
Oh, wow.
Then he couldn't figure out how to drive his car. He had a stick shift. He could not figure out how to do it anymore. He didn't know how to drive his car. Like, in the middle of driving, he forgot how to drive it. And he was like, oh, my God, I'm going crazy. There's something wrong with me, like, bad. And that's, like, right before, I believe he said it was right before they checked him into the hospital. And
I bet.
Pumped him full of IV antibiotics and figured out exactly what it was.
Well, I had plenty of ticks on me, but, you know, knock on wood, never had Lyme.
Yeah, man, I wish there was a way to stop it. Like, I wish, there doesn't seem to be any, I think... It's in California in particular, it's misdiagnosed a lot because
right.
it's not here yet
it
in
is.
Mass.
It is. They found it in Mendocino, but it's not
in mass.
Not like, yeah,
right.
right. Not in mass. Yeah.
Yeah. In the East Coast, they think something like, I think they were talking about Long Island, where they were saying some absurd number, like 50% of the ticks have Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
There's something crazy like that.
I went mushroom hunting 2 summers ago with a fellow chef friend of mine named Anita Lowe. And so we were out mushrooming and by her place in the eastern end of Long Island. And, you know, we cooked some mushrooms, had a good time, blah, blah, blah. So I get back like 48 hours later and I find 2 tick nymphs right in the band of my boxers. And I'm like, oh, shit. And so I immediately rushed to the doctor and I got that. They give you a 3-pack of Cipro and you go boom, boom, boom and try and knock it out. And... seem to work.
Wow, you got to get it quick, huh?
Yeah, you got to get it really quick.
Those little fuckers. I did this show for Sci-Fi called Joe Rogan Questions Everything, and one of the things that we investigated was this weird disease called Morgellons. Have mm-hmm. you ever heard of this?
Not by that name.
Well, it's a weird. They think it's a psychosomatic disorder where these people believe there's something wrong with them, but there's not, and they have these parts of their body where they just itch incessantly and they can't stop, and then they believe fibers are growing out of their body, and they'll get like carpet hairs in there, and they think that it's growing out of their body, you know, carpet fibers,
mm-hmm.
and they're convinced. But one of the guys that I interviewed was a doctor who also had Morgellons. And what he had a really unique insight to it, because he said that as a doctor, one of the things that he found is there's a direct correlation between people who have this disease and Lyme disease. Hmm. They almost all have Lyme disease. And he thinks that what's really going on is that people – and this is a guy who is like talking about his own – like his brain malfunctioning on him. He was saying that people who have Lyme disease, that there's some sort of a neurotoxic effect of Lyme disease which distorts reality to the point where these people think these fibers are growing out of them. And he was talking about himself, like he saw something moving around in his eye, like saw something wiggling around on the surface of his eye, and then it wasn't there anymore. And he realized, like, okay, this is not real. Like, I'm seeing something that's not real. And then as he got deeper into it, he found that all these people that had this bizarre Morgellons thing also had Lyme disease.
Makes sense. I mean, if you know about the symptoms of toxoplasmosis.
Yeah.
Which it makes mice really dig cats.
Yeah. Well, it makes them sexually attracted to cat urine. People don't know what we're talking about. Google Robert Sapolsky from Stanford University in Northern California. I've been trying to get that guy on for years. He's just so not a publicity whore. I can't get him on. I'm like, I'll fly to you, dude. He's like, I'm busy. I'm like, fuck. He's an expert in – well, he does a lot of primate work too. He does a lot of work with baboons and stuff too. But he's like the foremost expert in the United States of toxoplasmosis and the effects of it. It gets them horny for cat urine. It literally changes the sexual hardwiring of a rat, gets it horny for cat urine. They literally get erections and they go running around near cats. They're not scared of cats. Takes away their fear. The cats eat them. And because of that, it gets into people. The cats are around. It doesn't seem to affect the cat's behavior.
Yeah.
The cats are just carriers. And then it gets into people. Makes people more aggressive. Makes people more prone to get in accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Disproportionate amount of motorcycle crash victims have toxoplasmosis.
Interesting.
That's what Sapolsky pointed out when he was doing his residency. He was doing some work in emergency rooms, and one of the surgeons was saying there's a disproportionate amount of motorcycle victims that have toxoplasma. So when a motorcycle victim would come in, they would test him for toxo.
Huh. Interestingly, toxo is one of the few diseases you can pick up from deer.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get it from deer?
I'm not entirely sure. I think it's contact or eating undercooked venison.
Really?
But it's very rare. It's actually, I think there's only been like 6 cases in the last 20 years that the CDC reports. But ironically, there's a guy who is on the Facebook forum that I run was one of the 6.
Oh, wow.
Like, what are the odds, right? And he's like, well, you know, I'm one of these guys. And it messed him up pretty bad.
Like, in what way? What did you say it did to him?
A lot of the same symptoms that you were talking about.
Risk taking, aggressive behavior.
There were some blood problems too. Like I can't remember for the life of me, but it was, you know, like his blood pressure spiked, and it was significant.
Well, it's what people when they talk about crazy cat people. That literally is what they're talking about.
Probably, yeah.
Oh, 60% of France at one point in time had toxoplasma.
Wow.
Because of all the cats roaming around, they think they've gotten it down to as low as like 35%. Same as Brazil. Brazil is somewhere around 40%. 40% plus of people that live there have toxo.
Hmm.
There's also a disproportionate connection between toxoplasmosis rates of infestation or infection and successful soccer teams.
They're risk takers.
Yeah, risk takers, more aggressive. Mm-hmm. It's very strange.
You should test MMA people.
They also, I know, again, it would be off the chain. It'd be a real problem.
I love my kitty.
I'm fucking cat crazy, bro. I think there's also some sort of a connection between sexual promiscuity in females.
Hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff they're working on to try to figure out what exactly these fucking parasites are doing to people's brains.
Well, you've heard of the cordyceps, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Make the zombie ants.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there's good strains of cordyceps,
you
too.
You want to climb to the top of that leaf.
Well, they this is what people don't know, what you're trying to talk about, is there's a mushroom that infects, the spores infect an ant, convince the ant to go somewhere high so that these cordyceps mushrooms grow inside the ant's body, and then it explodes and sprays spores through the air, infecting all around them.
It's so gnarly,
so
dude.
Crazy. Nature's so nuts.
Like,
man.
If you watch the movie, like the movie Alien, so I don't know if this is 100% true, but I've always heard that the creature is a mashup of real insects.
Is that the bug? Okay.
Yep.
So is this a dead one that has it already? Is he about
to blow?
Yeah,
you see it's time lapse?
So in the time lapse, this mushroom is growing out of the back of this ant's head. Like this ant has been killed by this fungus, and it's now manifesting itself in this growing form that's not really a plant. That's another thing that people misconstrue about fungus. It's actually closer to an animal than it is to vegetation. They breathe oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. So this is some fucking freaky-ass alien life form that's growing out of this ant's head. Look at the size of that thing. It's huge.
That's so gnarly.
Kills the ant. And it grows mushrooms out of it, and then the spores blow up, and
that's a
God,
cool one.
That's so bizarre. Look, it's popping through its exoskeleton. That's so creepy.
Now you know where Ridley Scott got it.
Oh, yeah. Well, do you know about that aquatic worm that infects grasshoppers?
No.
Oh, this is a great one. This aquatic worm.
I love how focused and direct our conversations are.
Yeah, so every one of them I do. I don't have anything focused and direct in my life. But these aquatic worms aquatic? Yeah, it's aquatic worm, right?
Parasite, yeah.
Yeah. It gets inside a grasshopper, and this is one that's infected a praying mantis, and this one's going to burst out of the praying mantis. But when this aquatic worm gets in, because you get it wet, that's when it'll come out. But the aquatic worm that gets inside grasshoppers, when it reaches gestation, when it reaches its when it's time to be born, it rewires the grasshopper's brain and talks the grasshopper into committing suicide. So the grasshopper jumps into a lake and drowns, and the aquatic worm comes out of its body and swims away. Like, look at this thing.
That's so nasty.
Look at the size of this fucking thing that was living inside this praying mantis while it was alive. So it takes over the mind of these beings. I mean, look at the size of this thing. I mean, it is a solid 30 to 40%, maybe more, of the mass of the body of this being.
Wow. That's so gnarly.
It's hard to believe when you look at the size of this thing because it's continuing to come out. The grasshopper, if we had a scale, the grasshopper is maybe 2 inches long.
Well, that's a mantis. That mantis is probably a solid 4 inches long.
Yeah, I'm sorry, mantis. Yeah. So whatever length that is, the aquatic worm is 3 times that.
Yeah.
Which is just nuts. And it's living in its body. And it's still coming out as we're talking. Now it's out. It's fucking huge, man. And it's trying to find water. It's gravitating towards the water. But with grasshoppers.
Set that thing on fire.
I know, right? That's evil. We're lucky they're little. If you find the grasshopper, there's one where it talks the grasshopper. And the grasshopper just jumps in the water and just starts drowning. And then it pops out of its body. It's like nature's such a creepy, creepy thing in a lot of ways. Like the parasite world in particular. Like somehow or another, predators to me are less disturbing than parasites.
Oh, yeah.
Here's one that's coming out of, was that a cricket or something?
Yeah, so it's a grasshopper.
Could be. Look at that creepy-ass thing. Yeah, aquatic worms. Yeah, not good. Let's. I wanted to talk to you about more bizarrely edible things that maybe a lot of people don't think of. Sturgeon is one of them. I didn't know. I knew that people eat sturgeon eggs, but I really wasn't aware that sturgeon was that delicious as a fish. I also wasn't aware that it was legal to catch them. Like I for some reason, thought that they were endangered.
It's weird, which is one of the reasons why poaching is such a big issue, is because we're one of the last recreational fisheries in the country for sturgeon.
Really?
Yeah.
Because of populations?
Yeah, because the East Coast sturgeon was fished out around 100 years ago, and they're only now coming back in the East Coast, and there's still no fishery for them. So all of the sturgeon you see in restaurants in Sacramento is farmed.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So how do they farm a sturgeon?
Slowly.
I would imagine.
I think they have to be 7 years before they get to market size. So it's like making bourbon.
Yeah, because I was reading what it was another commercial fish. They were talking about the amount of time that it takes to grow a commercial fish to the point where you can harvest it. And it was some insane number, like 2 inches a year. Where it takes forever to grow these things to the point. I think it was catfish they were talking about, like large catfish. That's what it was. They were talking about what's going on in the Ohio River, that they're putting these catfish in lakes and they're taking them out of rivers. They're putting large catfish in lakes, but they can't survive.
Mm.
They can only live in these lakes for so long, but everybody wants to catch a big catfish. So they have these commercial catfishing businesses where recreational catfishing, where they'll take these people and they'll have them fishing in these lakes, and they use some sort of chemical in the lake that forces the catfish to bite. Yeah, and this
it's
chemical.
It's like a catfish bordello.
Yeah, it's really gross, man, because it causes these lesions on the catfish's skin. Ugh. So these people catch these catfishes, and they have catfish, rather, sorry, and they have these red sores all over their body because some chemical's been introduced into the water, which I guess the irritant causes them to, like, they're biting out of frustration, I guess, maybe?
Ugh. The unspeakable in pursuit of the inedible.
What's just so bizarre? Like, what a strange choice that people have decided. Let's take this animal outside. There's one with legions on it.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
see, another issue arises when bigger catfishes are introduced into pay lakes. Yeah.
Pay lakes.
Yeah, they have these lakes. I didn't even know there was a pay lake. Like, look at all the spots on that one. Look at the fucking spots on
That's
that
gross.
Thing. And see if you can find what it says that chemical is that they dump into the water, Jamie.
Just go to the Rappahannock River in Virginia. You'll catch a nice one. I've caught 70 pounders.
Well, in a river, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, how many of them are out? Which fish do you catch? Is it blue?
That's
blue catfish?
A white cat.
A white cat because it's a big one?
White cats, blue cats, channel cats. But yeah, blues and whites are usually the biggest.
Did you, okay.
Flatheads get really big too, but they don't live in Virginia, I don't think.
It's called juicing. Okay, the chemicals they put in the water make the fish bite. In the pay lake industry, it's called juicing. Whoa,
ugh.
Weird. Look at the fucking lesions on that thing. Ugh. Scroll up a little, Jamie. Back up. Look at that poor thing's body.
That's just wrong.
It's bizarre. It's not just wrong. It's bizarre. I tell you, I don't really understand how that ever got passed, how people are, like, accepting that. Like, that's a natural one. The one below that seems totally healthy that some got caught from a river. So these pay lakes is like a private land thing. Somebody owns them, and it just keeps dumping these fish in there. And apparently they don't live there very long.
Yeah, well, it's the fishing equivalent of those little teeny high fence places you see in the east. You know, go hunt elk on 40 acres.
Do they have those in the
east? Yeah, the east coast. Like, so, you know, in Texas, a lot of the high fence places are thousands and thousands of acres. But they have them in the Midwest and in the east. And sometimes they're painfully small, you know, like tens of acres.
Ooh.
Where effectively, you know, you're, it's like shooting something in a pen.
I saw one that was 10 acres.
Right.
It was on eBay.
Yeah.
There were Craigslist where this guy had put up this hunt in quotes. I'm doing air quotes for this enormous buck that they had used for breeding on this commercial deer property. See, if you own a piece of land in Texas, or in any place where they allow this, you can buy deer and then have these deer released onto your land, and then you can, air quotes again, hunt them. So they raise these things to maturity, and they give them this massive protein-rich diet, and then they also have great genetics on top of that. So these deer have these insane antlers.
Frankenbuck.
They're so strange looking. It's such a weird thing when you see them, and, you know, that is what a regular wild Colorado mule deer looks like. It just looks normal. It's like, that's what you see. Everybody recognizes it. That's what it looks like. When you see one of those bizarre farm-raised bucks, it looks like they have bushes growing out of their
heads. It does. It's really bizarre. I don't even think it's attractive. You know,
it's gross.
It doesn't have that, you know, that classic line of a deer that is kind of, I think, is imprinted on our brains.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's some weird thing like double E fake boobs, right? Like, okay, what are you doing? Like, you went crazy. You went too far. Like, you did something that doesn't make any sense anymore. Yeah. Another fish that I wanted to ask you about is, what's up?
I found out what the juicing.
Okay, what's the chemical?
Copper sulfate.
Oh.
Ooh.
So it says that it forces them to feed and move excessively. And then it also is used to, like, treat vegetation and algae in other lakes.
Kill,
but then used into an excess, it can kill fish too.
But it says it's designed to kill unwanted lake vegetation.
Yeah, when you look up just copper sulfate
and fish. It also used to be put in canned green beans to keep them green.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. I wonder if it made people move around a lot after they ate them. How fucking strange, man. God, what kind of a monster pours that into a lake to get the fish to eat more? I want to talk to you about gar. Have you ever had gar fish?
I actually haven't. I know guys who have. Mm. I know you have to pretty much clean it with a hatchet.
Yeah.
And I know that everybody I know who's eaten gar says it's awesome.
Yeah, I've heard smoked gar is awesome. Mm-hmm. Jamie, that's a little tiny one. Pull up. Yeah, look at that.
There you go, yeah.
That is a crazy fish that's been around for what? How many millions of years has that thing been alive for?
Like over 100, I think.
It's totally primitive. I mean, it literally looks like some kind of a fucking dinosaur fish. And those are in Texas.
Yeah.
Natural.
Texas, Oklahoma, yeah. Arkansas.
Yeah.
Like what? Louisiana.
And can you catch those on a hook or do you spear them?
You can catch them on a hook.
What are they? What do
they
eat?
Have wire.
Yeah, you better have a lot of wire, right? Like those teeth.
If I remember right, they like live bait.
Oh, okay. What an enormous, fucking, crazy, weird animal.
Yeah, there's a big one.
Okay, that's a perspective shot.
That's probably an 8-foot gar.
What's a world record gar? Let's take a guess.
I'm going to guess 12 feet.
12 feet?
That's
really?
That's going to be my guess.
Wow, I'm going to go with 10. You're probably right, though. This episode is brought to you by Hostage Tape. First of all, what a great name. This is a product that I use, and I started using long before it was an ad. Your sleep game is about to get a whole lot better, kids, because I want to introduce you to Hostage Tape. Put simply, it is tape for your mouth. But you're probably wondering why you should even need that. Well, if you're a mouth breather, if you snore a lot, or if you suffer from sleep apnea, this could make a big difference. This mouth tape can reduce or eliminate snoring and apnea, and at the same time, it'll help filter the air going to your lungs, increase your oxygen uptake, and improve circulation, which will make you feel more energized. It has tons of other benefits, too, like it helps with bad breath, dry mouth, and, of course, better sleep. For you and your partner, don't let bad sleep hold you hostage. Shut your fucking mouth with Hostage Tape. Buy it today and get a special buy two, get one free offer. That's a 90-day supply. Just visit HostageTape.com/Rogan. That's HostageTape.com/Rogan. New world record. That doesn't look like 12 feet. Let's find it on the web. What is the world record? 279 pounds. Wow. How big is that? How long is it?
279 pounds caught in 1951.
That's the world record?
Yeah.
Whoa! That's not from 1951. They didn't have, look at the size of that thing.
Big old alligator gar.
Now, is there a difference between an alligator gar and a regular gar?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different species.
Oh. And you can eat them all?
As far as I know.
See, yeah, that's another animal. I didn't know that you can eat these fish until I watched one of those crazy reality shows where people live in the mountains. You know, they were one of those subsistence shows.
You didn't make people eat them on Fear Factor?
We made people eat animal dicks. We never made people eat gar. It's and it literally has an armor plate on the outside of it, right?
It's like you need like a hatchet to get through it.
Yeah, I've seen people cutting through them with what looks like
the Sawzall and stuff.
No, it was what they were using was like something you would trim branches off a tree with.
Loppers.
Like, crack, crack, crack. Just try to cut through that stuff. 47 inches in girth. 8'5". Oh my God. That's a giant thing. So, that's not a world record, right? That's just a giant one. Oof, what a weird animal. And it's just strange to me also that some animals figured out how to stay alive, like alligators and crocodiles for, you know, X amount of million years. Well, all these other things like largemouth bass are like so much more recent. And these things swim amongst them. These strange remnants of a much more savage past.
Like the coelacanth.
Yes, that's a great one. Because that one, they thought until they caught one, it was like the early 1900s, they thought it had been extinct for millions of years,
right? Yep, off the coast of South Africa.
Yeah.
Now, apparently, like, you can catch them. There's a place where you can catch them.
And it's legal?
Well, I think it's catch and release, but it's not that, you know, that was, coelacanth.
But when you
catch them, like they're super common, but it's not like a news event when they catch one anymore.
Oh, there's one right there. Wow, what a strange-looking prehistoric creature, too. Actually, I think the gar is more impressive. That's bizarre looking, but the coelacanth, is it a deep water fish?
Yeah, it's a deep water fish.
Now, when you catch and release a deep water fish, aren't they fucked though?
Not all.
Just bringing them up through the top,
like rockfish are in the Pacific. They certainly are. They don't have
their eyeballs pop out of their head.
Right.
That's weird.
But
man.
Lingcod don't.
Oh, So if you catch a ling cod, you can bring them up to the surface. And is that a coelacanth that someone caught on a hook, Jeremy?
Yep, looks like it.
And so when you catch a ling cod on a hook, you can just throw it back in the water, mm-hmm. and even though it goes 500 feet to
the
surface.
I've never seen a ling cod with the bends.
Really?
And I rockfish always get them.
Hmm. So it's just a matter of the frailty of the...
It's just the way the fish is built. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and here I'm just guessing, but ling cod will come from the bottom all the way up to the top to hunt, whereas...
beautiful fish, too.
Whereas so rockfish, cool looking. Yeah, there's bucket mouth.
God, what a cool-looking fish, and delicious, too, right? Yeah,
big old bucket mouth.
Yeah, ling cods are... That's another one that looks like it's not supposed to be alive anymore.
They're so awesome.
They're so awesome looking.
My biggest
man.
One I ever caught was a hitchhiker. It had hit a rockfish.
Wow.
And so I brought the rockfish just to the surface, and the ling cod wouldn't let go.
No
so
shit.
So we gaffed the ling cod.
Wow. That's interesting.
23 pounds.
Whoa, it wouldn't let go.
Nope.
Wow.
It'll let go if you let its head break the water. But if you keep its head in the water, it won't let go.
Oh, so when his head comes out of the water, he's like, oh, this is bullshit.
Right. He's like, huh, that's peculiar. Let's go.
Look at the mouth on those fuckers.
Oh, yeah, a blue one.
Wow. So
How'd you like that to be the last thing you saw?
Yeah, that would suck.
It would be like tripping in hell.
Sucked into that vortex. Yeah, that looks like something from that movie, The Event Horizon, when the demons had taken over the spaceship. Like
or Dune.
Get sucked into that. Yeah. The teeth on that fucker. It's a hard-ass world that thing lives in.
Don't lip them when you catch them.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, you got to grab that thing around the gills or gaff it or something. What is all that we're looking at here?
He's gutting it.
What a strange stomach looking.
Yeah, they turn blue like that. I used to know... they turn blue because of what they eat. And I think it's...
like salmon, when you buy commercial salmon, they have to dye the skin because they're not eating the same kind of bugs.
Yeah, well, farmed Atlantic salmon, yeah.
Yeah.
Eating... The red is from krill.
Extremely rare blue cod.
Okay, so this is hilarious. So I've seen this article. Extremely rare blue cod caught in Australia, which is... So it was explained to me that they are extremely rare in Alaska.
Does that say Alaska or Australia? Scroll
up. Alaska.
Alaska.
But
yeah.
They're incredibly common where I live.
Oh.
I once hooked into 13 ling cod in one fishing trip, and 6 of them were blue.
Whoa.
So.
And this is all off the Northern California coast?
Yeah, this is off the Marin, Sonoma coast. And
that's a great area to fish, right?
It is. But it's like not extremely rare. Yeah, but apparently up there they're rare. But it has to do with their diet.
Okay, so maybe did it migrate from up there all the way up to Alaska?
Well, they're native. They're native all the way up to Alaska.
So they
like
don't...
the really biggest ones are if you catch them in Alaska.
Oh, really?
Like 50 pounders.
Ooh.
Yeah. The ones that would eat a toddler.
Well, Alaska has those goddamn halibut that are like...
Mm-hmm. Barn doors.
Giant.
So I was sort of sad because I went up there because I wanted to catch a giant, and then I was reading about it before, and I realized that every halibut over about 125 pounds is a big breeding female. So it's a bad idea to land it because actually the halibut stocks in Alaska are not doing that well. So get it to the surface, get a picture of it. So your ideal halibut apparently is like an 80-pounder or an 85-pounder.
That's plenty big.
Right, which is plenty big, and it's not necessarily a big breeding female, and so you're not really going to hurt the species. It's like the guys who keep the 400-pounders, absolutely. And the weird thing about fish breeding behavior is that it's exponential. So... a buddy of mine, a guy named RJ Waldron, he landed a 53-pound striper in the Delta. Actually, it was a fishing buddy. And they tried to revive it, but it died, which mm-hmm. sucked. But it was that thing there would be like the super mom for thousands and thousands and thousands of stripers, whereas an 18-inch striper that was a female would not be, it's not linear. It's not like they get a little bit more. They get exponentially better, more, you know, they have exponentially more breeding power as they get bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's generally not a good idea to eat your seed corn, even if they're fish.
Wow. I had a friend of mine who caught an enormous halibut on a boat. It was one of those charter boats, mm-hmm. fishing boats. And
like Homer.
When they were pulling it up, they cut the line on them. And he was so pissed off. He's like, they were trying to tell him, like, look, you can't keep this one.
Right.
It was huge. He was like, I go, how big? And he's like more than 300 pounds. We have, I don't even know how big it was. Big breeding
female.
Big. Took forever to bring in. But once we got it to the surface, they wanted to cut the line. They let it go.
Yeah.
And he was so pissed off. He just
the right thing to do biologically.
Makes sense. It totally makes sense. And they're such a cool looking animal too. Like what a strange
bad
flat
ass.
The size
teeth.
Of that fucker.
Yeah.
Bad like that
ass
one's too
teeth.
Big. 255 pounds. They fucked
right.
up. They shouldn't have killed that one, right?
I wouldn't have. I mean, it's legal. It's not illegal.
Right.
But it's
but you're
you
not
know,
supposed to do it
because the stocks are they're okay, but they're not doing super great.
Well,
it's just you know because the chances are the next drop down you're going to catch a 75 pounder anyway.
Right.
So
really,
there's
Jesus.
There you know if you see the ones on the right.
Uh-huh.
That's what you should be keeping. The 287, I'd let that go. Because think about it. How much halibut are you going to eat, really?
Right.
I mean, yeah, I know. Most guys are going to go up to Alaska once a year. So, but still, those other ones are in the 70s. You know, there's easily three or four of those in the 70-pound range.
287-pound fish is a big-ass fucking fish, man.
And the flake, the flake on those big halibut is so big that it gets so coarse. That they're okay. I mean, they taste fine, but they're harder to cook.
When my oldest daughter was, I guess she was like 12, somewhere around then, 12 or 13. She's real sensitive. She's a very sweet person, and she wanted to be a vegetarian. And you know, and she was a vegetarian for a while. And then she started eating meat again. But she always loves animals. And I said, well, listen, let's go fishing. And this is before I ever hunted. I'm like, let's go fishing. We'll catch a fish and we'll cook it. And it's a kind of a cool experience because you get to experience catching something and cooking it. So we went out on this boat. 5 minutes into the trip, we catch a fucking marlin. All right. And
where are you fishing?
Hawaii.
Oh.
We're in Hawaii. And 5 minutes in, we it's not a big marlin. It's about a 70-pound marlin. It takes a while to get it on board. We get it on board. And then the guys who run the boat beat this thing to death in front of her with a club because that's what you do. You get a marlin on board, you beat it to death.
Why?
That's the only way to stop it from flopping around and
going
all over
the place.
Why were
they keeping a marlin?
They kill it and eat it.
Oh.
They eat them.
Okay.
Yeah, they smoke them apparently.
Okay.
But that was another thing. I thought marlins aren't good. I'm glad you just said that because the most recent trip that I had, I was in Hawaii just a month ago. And
that's the only state I've never been to.
Oh, my God, you got to go. That's a magic place. That's a real – I think Hawaii has an energy that when you get off the plane, you go, oh, we're here. Like, it's got a feel to it because you're on a fucking volcano. You're on a volcano in the middle of the ocean. I mean, that's really what it is.
True.
It's a volcano popped out. I mean, we took a helicopter where you fly over the volcano as it leaks into the ocean.
Oh,
you see
cool.
the steam coming up as the lava's flowing. It's amazing. Anyway, they pull – I mean, she's such a sweet kid. She's so sensitive and friendly and nice, and they beat this fucking marlin to death in front of her. And then they're covering it with bags of ice, and they're all psyched, and it's making all these weird noises. And then, like, she just starts to calm down and get over it. And then 20 minutes later, it starts flopping again. It's not totally dead. She's like, oh, God. I've never been able to take her fishing since. She's 20 now. She's like, fuck you. Fuck you, Dad. What did you do? And I'm like, honey, this is where we get fish. This is where fish come from. Yeah, it was the size of a dog. It was like, you know, a dog-sized thing. It was.
Yeah.
It wasn't like we brought in, you know, a 12-inch trout.
Right.
It was a giant-ass living creature that these guys beat to death. I mean, it's a small boat. It's they beat it to death 5 feet from her. So 5 feet away, they're beating this thing with a club.
Wow.
Yeah, and
that's kind of dramatic.
It was very dramatic. It was a lot of... So that was the end of that. We've talked about taking her hunting, but I think still that fucking one marlin messes with her. But they were telling me that you had to smoke it. But on the last trip that I was on, which was about a month ago, these guys were telling me that no, you can cut it and eat it like swordfish.
Yeah.
You cut it and grill it.
There's no reason why you couldn't.
Have you ever had? You've ever had it though?
I've never actually eaten it.
So why were you saying? Why would you keep marlin?
Because almost nobody does. Like you know, like if you go to Costa Rica or Baja or the Caribbean, they're caught. They're catch and release only.
Now, do they ensure the population?
I think they do. I mean, because I've heard that the Hawaiians eat them, but I've never eaten it. And that's just. But yeah, I mean, almost all marlin fishing is catch and release.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's the big trophy fish, right? That's the one that they want to
have
on the wall. Yeah, it was the only time I ever caught one.
Yeah,
and we caught it maybe 10 minutes into fishing.
Now, swordfish, get that big.
Yeah.
But then that one's coming over the rail.
Yeah, that's a delicious fish, yeah. Right? Now, you think that tastes significantly different than a marlin?
I bet they're pretty similar.
I would like to know. Well, I just wanted to ask you about gar because I've always wanted to go gar fishing because I've seen them. And when you see those images that we just looked at, like, God damn it, I want to see that thing in real life. I would wish that you had tried it.
I've tried a lot of things.
Yeah, how have you not
paddlefish,
tried?
Paddlefish, bowfin.
Paddlefish is an interesting one, right? That's a Sacramento fish too, isn't it?
No, that's a Missouri River thing.
Oh,
They're cousins of the sturgeon.
Oh. Okay, and that's one that doesn't really have, they don't have any bones, right?
Right, neither do sturgeon.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so sturgeon's a lot like a shark in that sense.
Yep.
But sharks have bones only around the jaw.
Right.
Now, there's also some weird thing with the paddlefish where you pull that spinal cord out of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what a weird-looking fucking thing that is.
They're pretty tasty, though.
That's what I hear.
And if you've ever had lumpfish caviar, that's what that is.
No, I've never. What is a lumpfish caviar?
It's just caviar out of a paddlefish. I don't know why they call it paddlefish, but they should just call it paddlefish caviar, and which I think they are now.
Something about the restrictions on commercial paddle fishing because of
I don't think there is any concern.
No?
Well, I think it's all recreational now. And in some states...
Right.
Wow.
Look at that fucker. That looks like a fake animal. That doesn't even look real.
The football fish.
But I think that concern was about the caviar, right?
Right. So there was, again... there was an illegal trade in paddlefish caviar. So there's some states where you can keep your fish, but Fish and Game keeps the caviar.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How bizarre.
That's not, I don't think that's cool. I think it should be illegal to sell, but like in Missouri.
Why would Fish and Game keep the caviar? What are they going to do with it? I think it's going to go to waste?
I think they sell it.
Oh, that's even weirder.
Yeah.
That's really weird. Well, I would.
I would hope. I mean, you know, Missourians will tell us, but I would hope that the proceeds from selling the caviar by Fish and Game would go back to like habitat restoration or something.
I would hope so too, but I would hope so that you could pay like an additional tag and get to keep the caviar.
Oh,
say
yeah.
If you caught a female and you pay an extra $30 or something like that and you keep the caviar.
Yeah, I know you can in some states, like Montana for sure.
You can in Montana?
Mm-hmm.
Like what, they have paddlefish in Montana?
Yeah, they're all in giant rivers. Like,
oh.
You know, name a big giant river in the middle of the country and they live there.
That looks like another one that just made it through
it did.
Evolution.
Yep.
How long has that fucker been around?
100 million years.
Ugh.
Easy.
There's a show on TV, I forget the name of it, but it's this guy who cooks weird stuff on like the Sportsman's Channel.
And oh, that's Scott Laseth's Dead Meat.
Yes,
Scott,
Dead Meat.
Scott lives like 10 miles from my house.
That's why I was going to bring him up, because he's a Sacramento guy.
Yeah.
And he cooked paddlefish.
Yep.
That's he pulled the spinal cord out of him. He's on an interesting show. He cooks everything.
He has one of the best self-deprecating sense of humor ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. I mean, the dude's on the road like 300 days a year.
Really?
Yeah. He does a lot of stuff for like... a group called Hunt Fish Feed, so it gets hunters together to donate tons and tons of game meat for homeless shelters, and they do a big cookout thing so that everybody gets a meal.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's cool stuff.
Yeah, but he's found a lot of fish and a lot of game that people thought was inedible. It actually turns out to be quite delicious.
I'll tell you one that he didn't.
What?
Python.
Oh, really? Not good?
He said it was like mainlining mercury.
Whoa.
He said it was the worst thing he's ever put in his mouth.
Wow.
Yeah.
Python
in the Everglades.
Huh. Did he try to do anything with it, marinate it or anything?
I think he tried it every which way but Sunday, and he was just like, no way.
None of it?
No, dude.
Now, how do you know when you're eating something like that whether or not it's actually edible?
Well, I think you can do some, like all birds are edible, for example.
All birds.
Yeah. Some say it's disgusting and fishy, but, and most mammals are edible. But like, you know, the livers on polar bears have so much vitamin A, they'll kill you if you eat them.
Really?
Yeah. So don't eat polar bear liver. Just a
dude, I was about
tip.
To.
Pro tip.
Another pro tip? Two in a show, folks. What a show.
I know. It's like so random.
A polar bear is an odd one, right? That's a strange animal in that it's just 100. It's a bear, but it's 100% carnivorous.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a vegetable to be seen up there, and it's adapted.
I've seen them eat seaweeds on TV.
Really?
Yeah.
I
think it's because they're freaking out because they have no sea ice anymore.
Oh,
and so they're just
man.
Doing whatever they can do to survive.
Ooh, yeah, that's creepy. There's a really fucking scary video of this polar bear. There's a seal on an ice shelf, and the polar bear slips up behind the seal, and the seal doesn't know. And the seal's like, oh, Jesus. And then just tries to get away.
And he's got that really sad look on his face. Yeah. I've seen that video. It's just awful. You lose, seal.
And he gets into the water, and then the polar bear is in the water right behind him seconds later. And then the polar bear comes out with it, and it's in his jaws. That's a goddamn ruthless animal.
This poppy's got to eat.
Well, there's no other way. You know, there's no, and it's enormous. So yeah, there it is. Look at it. He just slowly creeps up. I mean, literally like a shark. Look how slow he's just moving around. And that sea lion, is that a sea lion?
Yeah. No, it's a regular seal. So apparently they differentiate seals. So like that one's the good tasting one. And then I think if this is the one that gets eaten, it's the good tasting one. And then there's another one that is really nasty with sharp teeth. So the polar bear's like, I'm going to leave that one alone.
Like a leopard seal? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's not that bad. But it's some seal that lives up in the Arctic that's kind of badass.
Leopard seals are amazing.
Oh, yeah.
That's a crazy animal. Yeah. I remember that Marching of the Penguins movie. I didn't even know there was a leopard seal was a real thing. He's like, well, we're just chilling. Look at him. He's like, yeah.
Fuck.
And he's just right in the water after him. Sorry, dude. You ain't going to make it.
I like the silence. It's kind of epic.
There's a stand-up comedian, Kevin Fitzgerald. He's also a veterinarian, and I worked with him once in Denver. And he told me that polar bears are one of the few animals that when they come out of the womb, they're like the little alien from the movie Alien that bursts out of the chest. Like, like they're looking to bite you. And he's like, they are predatory from the moment they come out of the vagina. Yeah, he said they just look at you different. They look at you like you're meat.
Well, that's interesting. So another friend of mine, a woman named Rebecca, who's really good with animals, she's worked with all kinds of animals, but she mostly focuses on raptors now. But she worked with cats back in the day, and she said that mountain lions are big kitty cats. They're giant house cats. So if you can understand a house cat, you can understand a mountain lion.
Mm.
Leopards and jaguars, very different. Like, it's just like, it's exactly what you were saying. You know, they're looking at you for you to make a mistake. And it's just a very different vibe from those cats than from a mountain lion. It's not that, I remember that. Yeah, it was interesting because it's, you know, back to our talk about jaguars coming back into the United States.
Well, any animal that's forced to kill things with its face in order to stay alive is a sketchy thing to have in your neighborhood in San Francisco. They're just so big. They need so much food, too. I mean, you think about how big a polar bear is, how much actual meat that thing must need to consume in order to keep that mass.
A lot. I mean, there's a place called Oley's Big Game Lodge in Paxton, Nebraska. And it's one of these places. It's the middle of western Nebraska. It's kind of in nowhere. But it's where you get off the highway if you got to go eat. And you walk in there and you're like, holy shit, there's this giant 12-foot tall polar bear stuffed like right at the door when you open up the door. And it gives you an instantaneous notion of how small you are compared to a polar bear.
They're the biggest, right?
Yeah.
They're bigger than Kodiak bears?
Yep.
Wow. Yeah, that's a weird thing, right? An animal that lives where there's no vegetation and just all the life comes from the sea, and it's bigger than all of them.
See, you know, blubber must be good.
Well, isn't also that principle that the larger mammals...
Bergman's rule.
Yeah, the further north they go, the larger their body has to be in order to maintain heat.
Yep, it's called Bergman's rule. The Scandinavians.
Yeah. Well, that's another animal bears are that Steve Rinella likes to call charismatic megafauna.
Yeah, that's an old biological term for when, back in the 70s, when, you know, Save the Whales and everything. And everybody who was studying keystone species, like krill or, you know, things that aren't very charismatic, were like, man, everybody wants to save the charismatic megafauna. And what really is the key to everything of these is this indiscriminate, you know, krill or, you know, this little teeny forage fish or whatever.
Or like ants we were talking about. They say if all the ants died, there would be no life on this planet inside of 100 years.
Wow.
We'd be dead.
Even fire ants?
I think it might be less than 100 years. Find out what would happen if all the ants died. I think it's actually less than 100
even
years.
Even fire ants? I hate fire ants.
Well, they're not nice. They're definitely mean.
I first discovered fire ants. I knew they existed all the time, but I never actually encountered them until I was in Texas, in Austin, digging wild onions. And these ants crawl over my hand like, oh, look, there's ants.
I used to live in Florida. In Florida, they were all over the place.
What the hell? And my friend Jesse's like, fire ants.
People have died, for sure. There was some little old lady who I remember the story. She tripped and fell like right onto a mound, and they just consumed her with bites.
Wow.
Yeah, and just fucked her up. They just thought she was a threat and time to take you out.
God, what's going to be on that poor lady's tombstone?
I don't know. You're aware of bullet ants, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
Didn't Steve encounter bullet ants?
Yeah, in Bolivia. It's the same place where he ate a monkey.
Yeah, no thanks, dude.
You wouldn't eat a monkey?
No.
That's where you cross the line. But if someone cooked it in front of you and it smelled good, it was in the bowl, and you were with these people and they were all eating it, you wouldn't take a bite?
I don't know. I'd have to judge that when I got there.
I think you would.
I would probably try and get out of that situation before it ever happened.
I would worry about primate-to-primate diseases. Mm-hmm. Like, I know they're cooking it really well, but I know that prions, like the prions that cause mad cow disease that come from brain matter.
Well, you know, with chronic wasting.
Yeah. Is that from prions as well? Mm-hmm. Same thing?
Yeah.
And then chronic wasting disease, for folks who don't know what we're talking about, is a disease that affects deer, and it's really common in the Midwest. And they think that it may have originated, at least this is the rumor, from these weird commercial deer farms where they grow all these deer and they all live together. Because apparently one of the things that happens is if deer eat out of the same spot, like, that's where it develops. Like, mm-hmm. If there's, like, a feed tray and they're all eating out of the feed tray, that's unnatural for the wild.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things that are difficult to, I mean, I get asked about it all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, well, what do I do with, if I want to make chops or if I want to make stock out of the bones of the deer I shot, what do I do with CWD? And I've done an exhaustive look at all the science that's out there, and it's never jumped the species barrier.
To humans.
It's primarily going to be located in spinal tissue. So you're going, pelvis to skull. And that's about what we know. So if it was me and there was testing available for my deer, I would absolutely do it. And if you're in the clear, you're in the clear. And if not, if it was too hard, I would probably keep the limb bones, but not the, anything off the spinal column, because I've just,
And you would keep the limb bones for marrow?
Yeah, either marrow or making stocks and broths. And then, cooking shanks on the bone.
Right, and when you do shanks, you braise them and slow cook them. And that's a neglected part of a lot of ungulates, right?
I think it's probably the single easiest way of, to use the stupid catchphrase, upping your game. Mm-hmm. Because grinding shank meat sucks because there's so much connective tissue, and they're easy to saw off with a sawzall or a hacksaw. They usually will fit in your pot, and they're amazing braised like that. And even if that's all you do different, besides your butcher will like you because all he's got to do is just saw them off and put them in a butcher paper and bring them back to you.
Now, you started your hunting and cooking career off. You started as a chef, mm-hmm. and then you wanted to get closer and maybe understand what you were cooking better. Is that a good way to describe it? Is that accurate?
Sort of. I mean, I started hunting in Minnesota, and my best friend was the outdoor writer for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. And we had been fishing at the time, and then hunting season came around, and he invited me out, and let me preface this, but he'd been sort of plying me with mallards and with rabbits and with some venison prior to me ever going out. So I knew
the stuff that he had killed, he wanted you to try. And this, and you were already a chef by then?
Well, at that point, I was a newspaper reporter. So I started as a restaurant cook, line cook and a low-level sous chef. Then I went into newspapers, and I was still as a newspaper reporter at that point. And I got into it because I wanted to eat these things. I loved cooking the mallards. I loved cooking pheasants. I loved cooking venison, and you can't buy it, so gotta learn to get it. And the other thing that was really life-changing about it was, so I'm a pretty good fisherman, and when I'm in a place for a while, you learn to read a body of water. In my case, back on Long Island, you learn tides, you learn weather patterns, you learn all of the little intricacies of what it takes to actually get on fish. So most anglers are just hooks and lines. The real fisherman knows where to put the boat to find the fish, knows how fast to troll, knows what angle to the waves you want to be, and all these little detailed things. And I knew that. My friend Chris knew this by looking at the land. Like, he could just take, at a glance, he could look at a field like, nope, no pheasants are going to be in that. And I didn't, how do you know? And he just knew because he'd done this a zillion times. And his ability to read land, like I could read water, I wanted that ability. And that, every bit as much as the eating part of it, was what brought me into it.
Now, when you say that you really enjoyed cooking them and you really enjoyed eating them, is it because the flavors are different? They're more complex? They're more, like, you know, one of the main criticisms that people have said to me when I talk about wild game, like, oh, I tried venison, I didn't like it, it's gamey. I'm like, God damn, somebody ruined you. Because it's just, it's not. Like, they did something wrong with it.
That's, I mean, there's two things to gamey. So one, I think we both agree that what we would call gamey is somebody screwed up.
Right.
So poor, almost 75% of all good venison care happens before the meat ever gets to the kitchen. So that can give you what we would call gamey. But, I mean, I've had people eat backstrap that it was perfectly prepared, perfectly cared for, and they say, well, it's kind of gamey. What they're talking about is that it doesn't taste like corn.
Mm.
Every meat animal, including to some extent salmon, that we will get in a supermarket is corn-fed.
They corn-feed salmon.
Yeah, it's in the pellets that they feed them. It's
Jesus
part of the pellets.
Christ.
Yeah, I know.
This goddamn corn industry that has its tentacles deep into America.
Right? And, you know, this corn tastes like it has a very particular flavor profile. And so with that flavor profile is broken by, you know, deer that ate something else, people are like, ah, it's different. Well, yeah, it tastes like something. It tastes like something that actually lived a life.
Tell me that about mule deer, that they don't like mule deer because mule deer tastes like the sage that it eats, and that they like whitetails because they eat corn. I'm like, Jesus Christ, man. Mm-hmm. Like, I've had mule deer. They taste great. You're out of your mind.
It's, you know, and then people will say, elk is so much better than deer. I'm like, okay, I get it. I mean, elk, there's some minor differences and subtle differences. And if you put one next to each other, yeah, there's a little bit of a difference. But it's not that dramatic. Like, I'm a duck hunter. The difference between a spoonie and a pintail is profound.
What's a spoonie and what's a pintail?
So a spoonie is a northern shoveler, and it's one of the least desired ducks that we
Northern own. Shoveler.
Yeah.
And is it a diver duck? Is that what it is?
It's kind of a hybrid. It's technically a puddle duck, but it dives more so than the other puddle ducks.
If you don't mind, explain to people what the difference is.
Oh, okay. So every duck that you've seen in a park with his butt up in the air, that's a dabbler or a puddle duck. So a diver duck is a duck that dives very deep. And the deepest of all are a third kind of duck called a sea duck, which, as you might guess, lives in deep, 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 deep water. So divers would be like bluebills, canvasbacks, redheads, buffleheads, goldeneye. And then puddle ducks would be obviously the mallard, which everybody knows. Mallards, pintails, spoonies, widgeon, teal. And so in general, puddle ducks taste better than diver ducks because of the, what they eat.
Mm.
And so, but ducks are all omnivores, much like pigs and bears. So you have a spoonie, which loves to eat shrimpy things and algae. Meh. Versus a pintail, which loves seeds. It loves seeds of all time, all kinds.
And that's a more tasty bird?
Any bird that eats seeds as a matter of habit, human beings are going to like to eat it more. Because it creates a set of flavors that we're more familiar with. Now, the exceptions to that are kind of fascinating. If you talk to Newfoundlanders or Icelanders or Inuit, people who are grown up eating seabirds, they love that fishy, low-tidy flavor thing that going on. Yeah, the same. I see you're
what's this?
Getting the hairy eyebrow.
I want to try, even though I know I'll hate it, I want to try that fermented shark that they love
Hakarl.
In Iceland.
No, you don't.
Have you had it?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what it's like.
Mm. Fishy natto.
What's natto?
It's fermented stinky soybeans. So
oh,
it's,
I've heard of that stuff too. It's disgusting, supposedly.
It's stinky, blue cheesy, fishy, ammoniated. It attacks your mouth.
Ammoniated?
Yeah, heavily ammoniated.
Now, the Iceland people, are they drunk when they're eating this?
I think it's just was there's nothing. It's like a polar bear. There's nothing else. So
they developed a taste for it?
Well, apparently you can't eat that shark fresh.
What?
Yeah. I think it's another vitamin A or something like that. There's some reason you can't eat that. It's a Greenland shark, mm-hmm. and you can't eat a Greenland shark fresh. So it was the only way to eat it was to ferment it.
How bizarre.
Yeah.
And so they became
Who was the first guy to figure that one out?
Yeah, right?
Let's eat the rotten one.
And how to prepare it. that you have to figure out how to ferment that thing. Because I've never seen or heard, I've seen videos of people trying it. I've never heard anybody's tried it that enjoyed it. Anybody who lives in Iceland, though, will tell you. Like, it's a delicacy. We like it. I'm like, I don't understand.
I wonder what our delicacy is. What is the thing that we, either in California or in the United States, really, really like that everybody else in the world is like, holy crap, how can you eat that?
That's a good question. I don't think we have anything like that. Our food is so bland. Like, an American food is like you think of a cheeseburger and fries or steak and mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
You don't think of anything that has, like, incredibly potent flavors to it.
Yeah, I mean, I can think of some regionalities, like Scrapple.
Mm, right.
But that's not, you call Scrapple regional American, but not dominant American food.
What's Scrapple again?
It's basically lips and assholes ground up really small and mixed with either cornmeal or sometimes, you know, oatmeal.
Yeah, but and that still won't be, like, potent.
It's baked in.
Is it? Yeah.
Liver mush is even more potent.
Liver mush?
Liver mush.
Mush, really?
It's basically that, but it's made with liver. And they're both breakfast meats. And, you know, I've had good Scrapple. I've not had liver mush that I really, really enjoyed. It's kind of you see a lot in South Central Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Tennessee, that area.
Well, that's right there, huh? Wow.
See, that's
Scrapple.
Yeah.
So it's like you cut it like a loaf, like a meatloaf.
Yep, and then you fry it.
Oh, wow. So you
It's not horrible.
It? Do you boil it? How do you get it to that state?
Oh, it's all liquid.
Jesus, look at this.
Yeah,
it's, I don't look good.
It's all liquid, liquid. It's basically like Scrapple is the scraps from slaughtering a pig.
So is it almost like a gelatin thing, like a head cheese type of a scenario?
It is, but I would say head cheese is probably a more wholesome product.
Jesus Christ. Well, head cheese is very strange. I didn't know what head cheese was.
Fromage du tête.
Yeah, until probably like 5 years ago. And I remember watching a video of someone making head cheese.
I like head cheese.
I've never had it.
It's okay. So here's the thing. All it is, well, there's a German way that is really dig on the gelatin. And I'm not super heavy on the gelatin.
And that gelatin comes from the collagen that breaks down in the tissue.
So take a pig's head.
Okay.
And typically, you will either have the ears thrown in there or you'll have an extra foot thrown in there for some more collagen. You boil it slowly with a lot of spices and herbs until it practically falls apart. Then you fish everything out. And then the iron rule of head cheese making is if it looks like meat, keep it fairly big. If you have no idea what it is, chop it very small. and then you pack it into a loaf pan or a sausage casing, and then you boil down the cooking liquid by half, and then that really concentrates the gelatin. And then you pour that hot broth over the mixture that you've packed into the loaf pan or the sausage casing or whatever, and then you put it in the refrigerator and it sets, and you eat it cold. So the best head cheese is where the gelatin is set just enough where it kind of melts when it hits the heat of your mouth. And so it's not nyang nyang, you know, sort of, you know,
chewy,
knocks gelatin like.
Right.
And it's actually very, very good. And it needs pickles and or mustard.
Pickles and or.
Yeah.
There's head cheese. See, it looks good. That looks better than Scrapple.
Oh, yeah. It's much better than Scrapple.
But it's a weird distinction. I mean, I guess it's because it's not dicks and assholes.
Right. More uteruses, please.
I mean, I've always been fascinated by charcuterie, just the idea that people figured out a long time ago how to dry things and preserve things. That's it? Head cheese right there?
That's how I make it. That's colpa di testa. That's an Italian style.
Okay. And then you slice it very thin?
See that arc thing in the bottom left-hand corner?
Mm-hmm.
That's a little beady slice of pig ear.
Oh, wow. Really?
Mm-hmm.
And that's edible? You can chew that down?
Yeah, well, it's been boiled for hours and hours.
It just becomes super tender? Because I think of them as things I feed my dogs. I buy those at the pet store.
If they're not boiled, yeah.
Yeah. Pigs are a weird one, man. That's such a weird thing because you find out how smart they are. Mm-hmm. And, like, commercial pig farming becomes very disturbing when you find out how...
That's another reason why I got into hunting is to... I have not bought meat or fish for the house since 2004.
That's awesome.
With maybe a handful of exceptions. I bought a chicken a couple of times, but... Part of that is I would prefer to opt out of that system because you're exactly right.
Yeah. I just did a podcast really recently with my friend Ari Ari Shaffir, who's a stand-up comedian, and it's his podcast. It's called The Skeptic Tank, and we went into that because he's never hunted, and he asked me about it. And that is what I gave him is pretty much my reason for doing it in the first place. I felt like I didn't want to be a part of that system anymore, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a vegetarian. I was like, it's going to be one of these things, either a vegetarian or a hunter, so let me try this hunting thing. And then I got into it, but it's the connection with the food, it becomes a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to explain that without sounding pretentious or without just repeating myself over and over again, which I've done many times on this podcast. But when you – I'll pull like an elk backstrap out of the freezer tonight and I'll thaw it out and I'll, you know, marinate that, put some kosher salt on it, some pepper and grill it. And it's a wonderful experience. Like, while I'm cooking this thing, I'm all excited. I remember the hunt.
Yep.
I remember, you know, seeing the elk, the whole thing. I mean, it's just – it's a totally – and when you're eating it, it's just rich with vitamins and flavor and it's alive. I mean, it's just – it's definitely not alive. But, I mean, it has this taste to it that's just so different than anything you're going to buy in a store.
Well, for me, as a cook, having entered this whole game as a cook or, you know, this pursuit of hunting – it really challenges me to make great food out of every bit because, you know, you broke it, you bought it. And tacos de lengua made from elk tongue, phenomenal. Head cheese made from a doe's head, braised shanks. Hell, I even made venison tripe.
One of the most delicious meals that I ever cooked with wild game was on our first hunt. Ranella cooked a deer head in the ground.
Oh, yeah. He did
like the Big Sky. Like he read about it in that book, Big Sky, the Guthrie book, and he decided that he wanted to try it that way. So this is like the first time he ever tried it. And we buried this thing. We put hot coals. Mm-hmm. He wrapped it up in cloth and wet cloth.
Yep.
Put it underground, poured hot coals all over it, and then buried
it first.
I do not remember, but it was amazing. Whatever he did it right. Maybe he didn't salt it. I don't remember.
I love how Steve will like always take the hard way out.
Oh, he's the hardest motherfucker on the earth. Every time I hunt with him, I feel like a pussy. He's just always wanting to do everything hard. And if he doesn't get miserable, like I watched a show once where he saw this giant bull elk on the first day of his hunt within like first couple hours, and he didn't shoot it because he didn't want to be done hunting.
Like, that's why you go fishing afterwards.
I'm like, you're out of your fucking mind.
Elk's dead.
Man.
Time to go fishing.
He explained it to me afterwards where it made more sense, and it was because he had just come from Kentucky where he had did another show and he had shot an elk in Kentucky like literally the week before.
Mm-hmm.
So he felt bad about shooting one right away. I'm like, it's not like you're going to let it go to waste.
Right.
And he's like, well, we have to make a show and I can't just shoot it on the first day. Shoot it on the first day and then pretend you're looking for an elk for three fucking days afterwards. Jesus Christ. Don't you know about editing? You're on TV. But his ethics are so strong, and his inability to be disingenuous is so powerful that he won't do that.
Well, the hunt I did with him, it's like, yeah, I'm older than he is. I'm like, I'd like to climb to the top of this mountain and look for things and then sit here for until I find something and then walk to that thing and shoot it. And he's like, let's climb all over these mountains. I'm like, woo. And I'm like, ah, oh, dude, I'm just going to sit here. Like, this is where we saw deer. I'm going to go. No, as it turned out, he was right.
Oh, he's always right. He knows what he's doing. I went on a mule deer hunt with him recently, and you know, I was like, let's go after them now. He's like, no, just sit and wait. You don't want to blow them out. I'm like, you sure? Just go. Let's go. He's like, you can go if you want. I'm like, okay. I go down the hill. They're gone. They fucking take off. He's like, we'll go after him tomorrow. I'm like, all right, tomorrow? Like, but it's like one of those things where your friend could read the land. Like, you have to listen. Mm-hmm. Like, when you have someone that has like this deep experience in something that's very odd information, like where the quail will be. Like, how do you know? Dude, I've been doing this.
I have that with ducks. I can do that with ducks and geese.
Is that your favorite bird?
It's, well, I don't
do
know.
Do you
if
have
it's my
a favorite bird
favorite,
to cook?
Maybe grouse.
Grouse.
Maybe grouse.
Never had it. What's it like?
Imagine it's what a chicken dreams about being when it grows up and goes wild.
Mm.
It's a wild chicken.
And just a little tiny wild chicken.
They're not that tiny.
No? What's a fat grouse?
I shot a big blue grouse in Utah that plucked, gutted, and dressed just, it looked just like a chicken you buy in the store. It was 2 pounds.
Ooh, that's pretty heavy.
That's about as big as they get.
That's
about like that.
That's a pretty big animal.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding.
And sage grouse are even bigger.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What's like the biggest world record grouse? Like a 5-pound grouse?
It'd be a capercaillie in Sweden. I think they're like 15 pounds or so.
Oh, it's a fucking turkey.
Pretty much. But they don't have turkeys there, so.
Wow.
So, I mean, I guess the biggest gallinaceous bird would be the turkey.
I was interested in what the difference between wild turkey and regular turkey is. And
it's surprisingly not as big as you might think.
Yeah. The breast was almost identical.
Except it's very narrow.
Yeah. But the wings, or rather the drumsticks, did have a different flavor to them.
Yeah.
It was more more distinct.
Mm-hmm. And they work for a living.
Yes. They're out there hustling.
Yeah.
Which is the same you could say about pigs.
Mm-hmm.
Like the darkness of the meat of wild pig is so preferable to domestic pigs.
I love shooting wild hogs.
Well, you have to, first of all. That's one of those things. That's one of the animals that really, when you talk to people that are anti-hunting and they just want to let nature run its course. Like, there's some animals where you literally can't do that. Like, pigs are one of them, especially invasive pigs.
So I've hunted pigs in California for years and years and years. So, and I've heard all these stories about Texas. And a few years ago, I finally went down to Southeast Texas to do hunting and cooking schools. And so the guy I was working with is in Bay City. And so we're down there, and he's like, okay, first thing you have to understand is that these are a problem. I'm like, well, what are you talking about? So we went out. And there are these herds of pigs, and like 90 pigs in a shot. They'll walk into a field and do $100,000 of damage in one night. And it's astonishing. And this is all year round. And I had no idea. Like, because, you know, if you've hunted pigs in California, it's a hunt. If you go to Texas, it's like, how many can you kill?
Mm.
And you still won't make a dent on the population.
There's a story that I've told before, but I'll tell it again just for the sake of this conversation. There's a new highway that they opened up in Texas, and the first night they opened up the road, 40 car accidents with pigs.
Wow.
just overrun. They were just overrun with pigs.
Wow.
Yeah, car accidents and wild game and population control is one of the most surprising statistics when you give them to tell people 2 million car accidents with deer every year, or 1.5 million at least in the United States with deer. And they go, what? Like, people don't know. Go, what?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, 1.5 million car accidents with deer a year, just in the United States. Yeah. And they're delicious.
Yeah, years ago I was working at the Pioneer Press in St. Paul. And I did a data analysis, one of the first ones that was ever done on deer vehicle collisions. And apparently, if you're in Anoka County, north of the Twin Cities, on November 8th at dusk, watch your ass.
That's the one day?
That was like, so you're like, there's this huge cluster right there.
Well, then November, it's the rut.
Yeah, November's the rut.
That's when they just get completely bonkers. Yep. They go running into traffic. And
well, you've been to a singles bar at closing time?
Yes. Well, I've also been to Iowa in the rut. I was just there a few weeks ago.
You got an Iowa tag?
Yes.
Wow.
I got a governor's tag from my buddy of mine, owns some property out there and knows people.
You're lucky.
Yes, very lucky. Yeah, you can get one there. It takes a couple of years. You know, you put in points. You can get one every 5 years. But Iowa's amazing. Like, the whitetail population is strong. And one of the reasons is they don't have a rifle season.
Right, it's shotgun only.
Shotgun and archery.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to work for it. Because if you're going to shoot someone with a shotgun, you got to be pretty fucking close. I'd rather use a bow.
Even with a sabot, rifle barrel, slug, you're still talking 100 yards.
Is that the most you could shoot one at?
I've heard guys shoot farther, but week in and week out, 100 yards with those rifled sabot slugs.
And I would imagine there's a giant drop to how far it falls in 100 yards.
Yeah, you got to be aware of it. It's like shooting at the top of the back at 100 yards.
Yeah,
you know, I shoot a 270 and I lose like 2 inches at 300.
And I've heard that with some places, some states, they allow you to use shotguns, but you can't use a scope.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, you can't use a scope on the shotgun. You have to use the old-timey
iron sights.
Yeah.
Or you could probably use a peep sight.
Do you have a favorite game that you enjoy cooking? Is there anything that you like, this is my favorite game to cook in a variety of different ways, or do you just like all of them?
Well, I think if you're talking about a variety of different ways, ducks and venison. But if you're talking about favorite thing to cook in general, go back to grouse. But grouse are not as versatile, but I love the flavor of grouse. But it's a whole bird that you're cooking.
And is it because of its wild diet? It just has a more complex flavor to it. Is it
very much so? I mean, it's there's nothing that tastes like a grouse. It's sort of like a chicken, but you'll know you're eating a grouse.
Now, well, I didn't know this either until fairly recently, that the as you were explaining before, that there's different kinds of ducks, and the ducks that eat seeds are preferable, but diver ducks you can eat.
Oh, yeah.
But they have
the
like, do you enjoy them?
Oh, yeah.
And but they have like a fishy taste to it because they eat
some
primarily seafood.
So this is a great example of diet. So brant, which is like a sea goose, there's East Coast brant and West Coast brant. And the season just ended yesterday, I think, on brant. And they and so on the West Coast, they are the best eating waterfowl there is, period, bar none, because they eat eelgrass. And they have a very clean, almost saline flavor. It's very, it's not fishy. It's not pondy. It's just, it's a, they're fantastic birds. You shoot at brant in the East Coast and they eat sea lettuce, a seaweed, revolting, like barely edible.
Really?
Like barely.
You just got to chew through it.
Yeah. But, you know, so canvasbacks, or they're a diver, redheads, they're a diver. For the most part, I'll always pluck them because they have a different diet. And, but on the other hand, golden eyes, buffle heads, most bluebills, but not all, ringnecks, a lot of those birds, you know, they still taste good, but I'll tend to skin them.
It is really fascinating to me that the taste of when you eat an animal depends so much on what the animal's diet is. And then it makes me think about my own diet and like what is going on with the cells of my own body. And you think about people that are on poor diets that have terrible food that they consume and they choose to drink soda all the time. And their tissue itself is affected so drastically.
Long pig, this one's sweet.
Oh, long pig. That's what cannibals called human. I don't know what that accent was, but I don't like it. have you ever had blueberry bear?
I've had manzanita bear.
What's that?
So manzanita is just a different bear, just a different berry that bears love to eat in Northern California.
Oh, okay. And how was it similar, like the blueberry bear concept?
Well, it didn't turn anything blue, but it was amazing. I mean, it was super sweet, super fatty, just very mild.
Yeah, that's what I hear, that blueberry bear is like the ultimate game. Like, then you get a bear in the fall that's been eating blueberries, and, like, Ranella did a whole episode about it on his show where he cut one open and it had purple fat.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Amazing.
There's actually a better one, and it lives right near you. So legend has it, so I believe the state record black bear in California is a 700-pounder from the San Gabriel Mountains in Ventura.
Christ.
So, or it's from Ventura County.
From Ventura?
Yes.
700 pounds? That's not far.
So apparently these bears live in the mountains and they come down to the avocado groves and gorge themselves on avocados. And it's been, it's one of my bucket list goals is to get what they call a guacamole bear.
A guacamole bear is supposed to be really good?
Only imagine how delicious a avocado eating bear would taste.
I wonder if it would affect it that much because avocados are a fairly mild fruit. It but is a fruit, right? Wouldn't you consider avocado fruit?
But the fat quality would be amazing.
Yeah, well, it's very rich in fat, right? I eat a lot of avocados. I wonder if I would... See, the thing about the blueberry bear, though, is that it's got that engaging sort of sweetness to it that I think would be really interesting. I don't think you'd get that from the avocado, right?
No. No, you'd have an urge to eat Mexican food, I think.
Is that it? What is this, though? The Ranella one? Yeah, it's just showing how when he cuts into it, This fat has this insane sort of bluish hint to it.
Huh.
yeah, he say, you see how that, I was like,
is this when he gives himself trichinosis?
Purple? No, okay. That was later. That
poor
was,
Steve.
Yeah. Well, it's just, he's just crazy. He's so the crazy. Best part he's about had everything, this fucking guy. He's it, had trichinosis. He's had
Lyme disease, got charred cardia, by moose.
Yeah.
Oh, he got Giardia?
Yeah, Giardia, yeah.
If you, the other cool thing is that if you were to get one of these guacamole bears, you can freeze it and be free of trichinosis. Because south of about Oregon, draw a line all the way across the country, the bears there, if they have it, will tend to have a variety called Trichinella spiralis, which you can kill by freezing.
Interesting.
So, but north of there, from the northern tier of this country and all in Canada and Alaska, it's called Trichinae nativa, and that one is resistant to freezing.
So it stays alive even if you have it in the freezer for months.
Right.
That's sick. What a creepy animal.
I know. Well, I mean, it's from up there, so it must be, you know, frost resistant.
I was surprised how good bear taste.
I was too.
Yeah, that's one of those ones where you go, I don't know if I want to eat this. This is just
same
a
here.
Teddy bear.
Same
this
here.
This is Yogi. This is all the anthropomorphizations of
charismatic megafauna.
That's the weird. I've never had people more mad at me for anything I've ever shot than bear. Like, they don't. People don't seem to be that mad about a deer. Some people are, but most people understand it. Like, you ate that. You're going to eat it. That's why you shot it.
We are who we are because we hunt deer.
Yeah.
You know, anthropologically speaking. I mean, there's all kinds of evidence to show that the reason why we can run, we were the only primate with an arch.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason that we can actually throw properly. The reason why that we can communicate so complicated in so many complicated ways. There's all kinds of reasons, of, you know, the structure of our shoulders, the structure of our hips. There are a great amount of the way we're built and the way we think and the way we act has to do with us teaming up to hunt large deer-like things.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you get this?
All over the anthropological literature. I mean, I could cite you a bunch of books, but there's, I mean, obviously it's debatable,
mm-hmm.
but the consensus is that there's an enormous amount of development that stemmed out of pursuit hunting and ganging up on things like mammoths and rhinos and large herbivores. And, you know, that's why. I mean, we're hardwired to hunt deer.
Well, one of the things that I said that I was describing to my friend Ari about it is there's this strange familiarity.
Yep.
And almost like this deep reward system that gets plugged into that you weren't even aware that you had when the deer's down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're quartering it and cutting it up, it's like, oh, I kind of know how to do this. Or at least I don't know how to do this, but this seems normal to me. It mm-hmm. seems familiar.
I mean, we've been, you know, this is the other thing about some of the research I've been doing lately is that everybody hunts deer or something like a deer. So all over the world. So my banker, a guy named Omar, I was doing some banking stuff and I was talking to him about this book I just wrote. And he said, oh yeah, you know, I really miss hunting gazelles in the eastern deserts of Lebanon.
Whoa.
Right? I said the same reaction. You know, I have a friend from the Yucatan who hunts deer in the Yucatan. And, you know, I have another friend from Hokkaido on the northern island of Japan who hunts the same Sitka blacktail in Alaska now that he used to hunt in Hokkaido as a kid. And, you know, South Africans and New Zealanders. And I mean, even if you can, you know, if you're smart and thinking out there, you're going to say, well, what about Australia? In Australia, I mean, I don't know if you've ever eaten kangaroo, but kangaroo looks exactly like venison. It pretty much tastes like venison.
Yeah, it's a crazy deer, right?
It kind
of
is.
A strange sort of ish. A weird hopping deer with a tail.
Ish, yeah.
Yeah, ish.
So, I mean, the human connection with hunting and eating something like a deer is very, very, is worldwide and very, very deep.
Now, this new book that you have here, I've been reading it. I was reading it today, actually. Buck Moose. It's a lot of, like, really interesting information about animals and about how to prepare them, the difference. One of the things that I thought was really funny is the whole point about testosterone.
Yes.
Testosterone stinks. And that, like, the animals that everybody wants, like the big bucks with the big racks, they're going to be smelly animals. They're going to be tougher.
If you get them before the rut, which is right. Not easy, but if you get them before the rut, they're perfectly fine.
But that's the rub, is that that's mm-hmm. when they're easiest to get, when mm-hmm. they're all horny and confused.
Yep.
But you've got some great fucking recipes and ideas in here, man. How long did it take you to put this together?
I've started, I don't know, maybe some of it 10 years, but actually sitting there writing it 2 years. You know, because all the recipes I had to test, and I had to send the recipes out to, you know, lots of readers, because one of the things that's important for me is that my recipes are as watertight as possible. So I send them out to civilians. I don't let other chefs test my recipes because first of all, they're not going to follow the recipe. Second of all,
they would add their own bullshit to
Yeah. I mean, because it's just, they can't help themselves.
Wow.
So
no kidding.
It just is. I'm at peace with it. But what I want is for somebody who reads what I write to be able to make what I made. So anybody who's ever sent a text message knows that if you've ever sent a text message, what you write is not necessarily what the person hears in their head.
Right.
So that can't go if I'm writing a recipe, because think about it, right? If I'm going to tell you to do X, Y, or Z with a tenderloin, there's only one, you only get one shot at it. There's only one set of tenderloins on any animal. And if I'm going to tell you to do something with it that's beyond whatever it is that you normally do, it better damn work.
Mm.
Because you can't just go to the store to get another tenderloin.
Right.
Like, you can get another chicken. You can't get another tenderloin. So
You mean a tenderloin from a moose or from a deer?
Right. Yeah. And so everything has to be airtight and tested.
Will any of these recipes work with domestic animals? Like, sure. If somebody's really curious about it?
Sure.
How would you know how to substitute?
I would say bison or grass-fed beef will get you pretty close in flavor, and lamb or goat will get you pretty close in size. Now, lamb doesn't taste like venison, but in terms of size, like a shank recipe, for example, or a shoulder recipe or a neck recipe, lamb would be a perfect substitute. But if you want to get close to what a good deer or an elk tastes like, grass-fed beef or bison.
And when people do buy commercially available venison and elk, doesn't it all come from other countries? Does it come from New Zealand, most of it at least?
Most of whatever it is that you will see called venison will be red stag from New Zealand. But there are elk farms in the United States that I've seen elk commercially for sale.
Really? Commercial elk grown in the United States? That seems wrong.
You might say that, but I couldn't possibly comment.
Doesn't it seem a little... But that's one of the weird things about wild game is that you can't sell it.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the really appealing things about...
Because they belong to all of us.
Yeah, yeah. It's also the market hunting is what wiped them out at the turn of the century. And
Even as late as the 1950s, it was a news item for somebody to get an 8-point.
Wow.
I know guys who...
An 8-point buck, what he's talking about, antlers, because they were almost wiped out.
Yeah, I mean, it was a news event, even in the 60s in some places. So it's like, these are the good old days of deer hunting.
Yeah. Yeah, well, when I was in Iowa, we didn't see any big deer that got close, but we saw this is crazy. They're here.
The biggest whitetail I ever saw was this giant in western Kansas when I was quail hunting.
Kansas is supposed to be Mecca, right?
It's a Mecca. I mean, Kansas, Iowa, you know?
Yeah.
Iowa and Kansas. For big giant whitetails.
Yeah, I know people that move there. My friend John Dudley moved there just because of the deer hunting. He's an archer, you know, he's a bow
hunter. A little obsessive.
He's a little crazy. Do you have a favorite mammal that you like to cook?
You know, okay, but the first thing that popped in my head was javelina.
Javelina?
And I think it's because I'm a fan of the underdog.
Oh.
So I shot a couple of skunk pigs. So a javelina.
They call them skunk pigs.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, it's not really a pig, right?
Well, it is, but it isn't. It's a peccary. Right. And it's native to the United States where pigs are not. And they look like pigs. They act like pigs. They are related to pigs on the family tree, but they're not that close. And there is no reason why people should hate javelina. So, like, if you go to Arizona or New Mexico, everybody loves javelina. Like, yes.
To eat.
Yes, to eat.
Really?
And if you go only to South Texas, oof, there you go.
Creepy fucker.
If you go to South Texas, they're like, they're disgusting. Or they're rats or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I was in South Texas, and I said to the landowner I was with, like, let me shoot a couple of javelina. He's like, all right. So I cleaned them because I was wondering about this mysterious scent gland that you're not supposed to break up, which is on the small of the back. It's like, you know, it's kind of like a javelina tramp stamp. And so, but if you skin the animal like you would skin a pig, you never see it. It's in the skin. So if you come underneath the skin, you'll never nick it. You have no problem.
Oh.
And it's just like a little teeny pig, and they taste fantastic. There is no off taste to them at all.
Describe it. Is it
pork
pig? Like pig.
Like no, more like pork, like domestic pork than wild boar is.
Really?
Yeah, they're almost, I don't know if they're obligate vegetarians, but they're primarily vegetarians.
I know. My friend Doug Stanhope told me that one killed his neighbor's dog. They surrounded the dog and mauled it.
Well, that's because, have you ever seen javelina teeth?
Yeah, they got big ass crazy
teeth.
They're
spikes.
Yeah.
They're actually like spikes where wild boars have like arcs, like cutters.
Yeah, well, they hunted this thing. Like they killed it on purpose. Look at that fucking creepy bastard. Jesus Christ.
Roar.
Ferocious looking, weird hobbit animal.
Hobbit pig.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a real animal, right? It looks like something from a movie, like Lord of the Rings movie.
But, you know, that said, I like it. I love cooking them because they're fun, and I like pork. And
you prepare it the same way you would cook like a pork loin? Yeah. Or
I tend to go a lot of Mexican, Central American recipes because that's where they live. And, you know, desert Southwest kind of stuff. But, you know, don't get me wrong. I love antelope. Probably pronghorn antelope wouldn't be my second favorite.
I've heard this delicious.
See, you'll hear it's delicious and you'll hear it's disgusting. And here's why. Because pronghorns they're super nervous animals. They're like high-strung deer, basically, even though they're not deer. Pseudocapra, something or other. That's their genus. They're their own thing.
Mm.
Weird side note. they're so fast because they evolved to run away from the cheetah. This will blow your mind. So the cheetah in Africa was actually a cheetah in the American Great Plains before the Ice Age. It migrated back over the land bridge and got itself into Asia and Africa. So the cheetah that exists now is our cheetah, except our cheetah died out in the Ice Age, and the pronghorn antelope did not. So the antelope is essentially waiting for the cheetah. Nothing can catch it.
Yeah, they're so fast.
Nothing can catch it.
People call them speed goats.
Speed goats.
Yeah.
And so they're super nervous, and they die really easy. Usually it's like, ow, I'm dead, and they fall over. and so you go – what you do is you go up and you take your little shot. Yay, good antelope. And then gut him right there. Throw the wobbly bits in a bag and throw it in a cooler and then get them out of the skin as fast as possible. Mm. If you do those two things, it's some of the best venison you'll ever eat.
Why do you have to get it out of the skin as fast as possible?
Because they burn hot. Their body temperature is hotter than a deer's, and their hide holds heat better than a deer. So those two things, plus the fact that they're super nervous like this, they can go off in a hurry. So what you see a lot of guys do is, like, let's say, you know, you and me and Steve, we're hunting antelope. And, you know, I shot mine first thing in the morning, and you shot yours, you mean an hour or two later, but Steve can't buy a shot, which is probably not how it would work, but for the sake of the story. Right. So let's say Steve finally gets one at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Yay. Then we would start gutting him. That's, you see that happen a lot. And our antelope will be ruined. His will be fine.
Oh, I see. So you just got to jump on it right away and get it to a cooler as quickly as possible.
Because you often hunt antelope in warm weather, too.
Very hot, right? Mm-hmm. Like New Mexico in the summer, right? That's the season.
Late August, September.
So it's like many things. Like we were talking about gaminess. It's just a preparation and an understanding of what you are required to do in order to make sure that this meat is edible.
Exactly.
And tastes good. There's a bunch of animals that people – you got to get out of here soon?
Soon.
We can wrap this up.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of animals that I think have no equivalent in domestic food, right? Like, what would you say, if you were trying to coax someone into trying wild game or being interested in wild game, what do you think would be one that you would start them off with?
Something that's familiar. So, duck, venison backstrap, anything with wild boar. Because it's basically pork.
If you had to pick a recipe out of this bag.
Out of this one? I would do just a simple seared backstrap with like a Cumberland sauce or steak Diane.
Steak Diane?
Steak
what is
Diane.
That?
So steak Diane is it's a 150-year-old recipe that's a classic for a reason. Diane is for Diana, the goddess of the hunt. So originally in France, it was a venison recipe, and it became a beef recipe later. And it is a recipe with cognac or brandy, a little bit of mustard, a little bit of cream, the drippings from the pan sauce.
Ooh, look at that.
Yep.
Good Lord, that looks good.
And that's actually my recipe.
Is it?
Yeah. I did that on Simply Recipes.
Oh, nice.
And so it's a million years old, and it is amazing. I don't think I've ever encountered anybody who has made my recipe for it who didn't like it.
God damn it, I want to cook that tonight.
It's easy too. That's the other thing. It's like it feels sort of chefy and date nighty, but it's the 30-minute meal.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, listen, man, your book's awesome. I've enjoyed a lot of your videos. I've enjoyed you on television before. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks.
And get to talk food and the origins and everything with you. And
I like our non-linear conversations.
It was great. It was fun. It's all mine go that way. I urge people to go out if you're a hunter or if you're just a fan of delicious food, go out and check this out. Buck Moose by Hank Shaw. And you have other books available,
yep.
Right? What are the other books?
My last one is Duck Duck Goose, which, as you might guess, is what about waterfowl.
You silly goose.
And then my first one is called Hunt Gather Cook.
Okay. And you are Hunt Gather Cook on Twitter.
Yep.
And the same on Instagram.
Yep.
And do you have a Facebook as well?
I do. And it's Hunter Angler Gardner Cook.
Okay. Thank you, brother. This was really fun. I really appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely.
Thanks, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow with James Hetfield from Metallica.